All right, welcome back, everybody. And it is the Dom and Colin podcast with you once again with a special episode for sure today. Very excited with what we have lined up. First of all, I am Colin here alongside Dom. Dom, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm very excited to be here talking about this, and I'm not quite sure how we can possibly do justice to the subject matter here today, but I'm excited to give it a try, at least.
Yeah, I think the bar is certainly going to be high if the source material is any consideration. But thankfully, Dom, we have someone here with us to help us break all of this down. It is the great Mario Lanza. Oh, hi, Mario.
Oh, yeah, I'm very busy. What's going on?
Yeah, Mario, of course, everyone who I think is, you know, at least a longtime kind of internet survivor fan will in some capacity be familiar with Mario. Very excited to finally have you on the show. Complete the set of survivor historians that we've now gotten all four of you on the show. But Mario, not only doing survivor historians, also doing the Funny 115, of course, and Staff Picks, now a new podcast about movies yourself. And today we're here to do a rare Dom and Colin podcast about a movie. But this is nothing new for you.
Wait a minute, I'm the last historian that you put on the air? What the hell?
I was about to jump in and correct Colin that we hadn't had Paul Esselstyn yet, then I realized that we had and I just forgot about it. So I'm sorry, Paul, we love you and we're thankful for your patronage.
All right, well, as long as you dissed Paul, I'm fine with that. So that, acceptable, carry on.
Wow, Dom, firing shots early. Paul was fantastic coming on with us.
Are you sure this is the same Paul that I know?
Yeah, Montana Paul, I think, as he's commonly known.
Okay, well, you said he was fantastic, so I thought maybe you switched him out with somebody else.
With a Jay Fisher, perhaps? Yeah. No, I'm talking to Paul, big fan of Gene, that Paul. I think we're on the same page there. But Mario, I don't want to bury the lead here. Let's just put it out there, because I'm sure people who have clicked the episode by now are already aware of what's going on. But we are here today to dive into a film that I don't think it's an exaggeration at all to say has totally achieved legendary status at this point, at least in the year 2018. And I hope that that's still the case many years and decades from now. We're going to be talking about The Room. First of all, I should know this. What year was The Room put out? Mario, the movie guy, do you know the answer to this question?
Oh, I actually didn't look that up, but I'm guessing it's either 2003 or 2004, somewhere in there.
I actually have the Wikipedia open, so I can find this out quickly. It was released June 27th, 2003, and I'm going to say has just aged even better. You know, it continues to age better with every day that passes.
Yeah, I'm not even sure where to start on this subject because there's a lot to talk about. The Room came out in 2003. It kind of became a local phenomenon in the LA area. It became a more nationwide phenomenon a couple years later, and that's when I got into it. And I got into it late. I got into it in like 2006 or 7, and it had been out for quite a while. So that's
tell
the thing
us about that. How did you get into it?
Okay. Entertainment Weekly, that was my Bible for many years. I'm a movie guy. I just love pop culture, entertainment, movies. And Entertainment Weekly had done an article on this movie. I don't remember the exact year. You might have to look this up. It's called The Strange Cult Behind the Room. And it was like the headline article in the magazine. And I'm like, what is this? I've never heard of this. And this, we're already 4 years into The Room's run by this point. So I got into it really late. And I remember reading about it. And they talk about this movie that was so bad, it's good. And, you know, there's screenings and it's already audience participation and just all this crazy stuff that we haven't seen in a movie since like, what's the other one with Dr. Frankfurter, Rocky Horror Picture Show? And that's the one they compared it to. And I'm like, I don't really want to get into the audience participation stuff. That's not really my thing. So I waited a good 2 years even after that article came out. And so now it's 2008. And one day I just had rented it through Netflix just randomly. And it popped up. Somehow it ended up in the top of my queue. And I told my wife, well, let's watch this movie. It's supposed to be so bad. It's awesome. And she's like, yeah, she kind of rolls her eyes. She's like, I've heard that so many times before. It's just going to suck. And I'm like, oh, well, let's just watch it. And so we started watching The Room, and literally like a minute into the movie, Tommy Wiseau shows up there with his unidentifiable accent where he's like, hi, babe. And I'm like, holy crap, this is the lead of our movie? He can't even speak English. And so we were mesmerized by literally how like this movie really was as bad and bad in a funny way as people had built it up to be. And we were just transfixed. And you'll appreciate this from the Survivor community that I went on to Rob Has a Podcast, one of my early interviews on that show. And Rob said, hey, Mario, how you doing? And I started the show literally with, oh, hi, Rob. And Rob's like,
wow, I feel very original now doing that exact same thing with you earlier this podcast.
Yeah, 10 years ago. But anyway, so Rob is like, oh, what's that? What are you quoting? Because he knows I'm quoting a movie. And I'm like, I just saw this movie, The Room. It's the most amazing thing. And again, this is 2009 or 10. This is a good decade ago.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing. I've been involved with it, and I got into it late. And now I'm seeing, you know, it become mainstream and becoming a big Hollywood thing where everyone's, you know, now it's the big hip movie that everyone knows. But this movie's been floating around forever if you're in California.
Well, would you take the Survivor historian's stance towards The Room in the sense of you really had to be there on the ground floor to appreciate what it is and how it came to be? Or if you're one of these people who heard about it through the grapevine a few years afterwards, can you really understand just the entire immensity behind it, I suppose?
Yeah, that's a great question because, again, I can't take credit for me being there during Ground Zero during the early days. Again, I got into it when it was already a national thing. So I wish I had been there with the just the kind of the groundswell that came up around this movie, how organically it developed an audience, and just the fact that it kind of got, you know, appreciated in an ironic way. I've never seen a movie that really built it up like this one did in my lifetime, and I probably never will. So I think you probably did have to be there at the start to really, really feel like you have some stake money in this one. And again, I didn't. I picked it up later. But I am kind of jealous of the people who were there in Hollywood at these screenings with 20 people just laughing their asses off and just telling all their friends. So I wish I had been there in that little core group at the beginning, but I wasn't.
Well, you were in Southern California at the time. Did you see that infamous billboard that just stayed in location for a solid, what was it, 5 or 6 years? Just Tommy Wiseau's ghostly visage gazing down upon the streets of L.A.
I saw it afterwards because I think you undersold it. I think it was there for more than 10 years. Like, it was there forever, after this movie came out. So I've driven in L.A. I forget exactly which road it's on, but it's right there in the tourist area, and I have seen it. But it was, again, after I already knew about the movie.
However many years it was, we're comparing that to the usual, I guess, 2 weeks or a month for the standard movie publicity billboard. This just became a permanent feature of the landscape, and that by itself, just the longevity, was enough to drive conversation, even if you had no idea what The Room was or why you would possibly want to go and see it.
Dom, what is your origin story on how you came to first be introduced to The Room? Because my origin story involves you partially telling me about it. So I'd love to hear how you got into it first.
So as far as I know, I discovered it through some offhand comment that Mario made a few years ago. So I'm hoping there's some chain linking up here that we can trace the ancestry back to.
Yeah, I had no idea, Mario, that you were my Tommy Wiseau grandfather here, so to speak. Like, I'm part of the Mario Lanza coaching tree for The Room.
You must be joking. Ha ha ha.
Yeah. So the way that I came about The Room, what we tend to do in our weekly Survivor podcasts is we'll give each episode a title that is almost always either some kind of varying degree of successful pun or a pop culture reference. So sometime during Survivor Philippines, like early post-merge, Lisa Welchel did something insane, and Dom titled the episode, "You're Tearing Me Apart, Lisa." And I got a tweet later that week from John Cochran, future Survivor winner John Cochran, saying, "Hey, I just saw the podcast title. Are you a fan of The Room?" And I said, "I'm not, but apparently Dom is. What is it?" And he said, "Oh, it's the best movie of all time. You've got to check it out." And I said, "Dom, is this true?" And Dom said, "Oh, yeah, of course you've got to check out The Room." So the first time I watched The Room, for the first few minutes, and I'll get to my breaking point, I genuinely thought I was about to watch like some amazing movie that I just happened to never hear of before. And it didn't register that it was like ironically considered great.
Yeah, that's that's an odd way to stumble into this movie. I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure your heart was crushed when you saw the truth.
It was just so staggering to be like, okay, all I know about this movie is that it comes at the highest of recommendations from Dom and John Cochran, both of whom seem to generally have really good taste in things. So this must be excellent. I can't wait to find out what a treat I'm in store for here.
Well, so you came into that knowing what my taste is, and I guess having a good sense of what Cochran's taste would be too. And Mario, you said you and your wife watched it together for the first time. She knows what your taste generally is too. So in both cases, we kind of know what we're getting ourselves into, hopefully. But a lot of people, they maybe hear about this through word of mouth, or someone tells them, partially as a prank and partially in complete sincerity to go and watch The Room right this second. And they're going in completely blind. And at what point do you think the penny drops that there's something amiss here that maybe it is worth paying attention to?
Well, like I said, it's literally when Tommy Wiseau opens his mouth as the lead of the movie. There's no way I can imagine anybody can get through that scene. Colin, you have, you know, the patience of the stamina of a camel. Somehow you made it that far. Yeah, what are you? Yeah, I can imagine you sitting there thinking, this movie's great. When does Meryl Streep show up? Like, when's Sir John Gielgud going to show up here as the butler? But no.
Well, I'm amazed you made it that far. I think I probably, if I had no expectations, I think right away I would have thought something was up. If just a random friend of mine had recommended it offhand, I probably would have been a little more suspicious right away if it didn't come with such like glowing praise. But for me, I made it all the way to the first scene in the bed before I was like, what the hell is going on here? What movie am I watching?
That's impressive. That is the best Room origin story I've heard so far. So you've officially made my day. Nice job.
Thank you.
When you go back and rewatch it, even from the first frames of the movie, things start to jump out at you that are clearly out of place. So when you have this opening credit sequence, normally you would have you'd be sharing the love around. You'd be spreading the wealth a little bit between all the people who are involved in the movie. And instead, we're introduced to a Wiseau Films production distributed by TPW Films, starring Tommy Wiseau, executive producer Tommy Wiseau, written by Tommy Wiseau. And you start to notice a theme develop over the course of this credit sequence. I think Greg Sestero like gets a brief appearance for a second or two, and then it's back to the usual directed by Tommy Wiseau, starring Tommy Wiseau, and that by itself, when you realize this character who has just appeared on screen with this hilarious accent is Tommy Wiseau, that's when you start to think, okay, I have signed up for something completely different here.
And it was also the very beginning the very opening is a shot of the Golden Gate Bridge, and I was like, excellent, got it, we're in San Francisco. And then it's like a full 2 minutes of 20 more establishing shots of San Francisco. I still was not sniffing it out that I was totally barking up the wrong tree as far as the expectations were concerned.
Yeah, I'm going to steal a line here from Mystery Science Theater. They use this line a lot. They established the hell out of this movie.
They sure do. And actually, going back to what Dom referenced about Tommy Wiseau getting all of the various credits for this movie, I don't know what kind of details have been like confirmed or whatever, but there's been a lot of speculation about how Tommy Wiseau financed this and the writing process and everything like that. Mario, what is the closest to the truth that we know as far as that kind of thing is concerned about the production and the financing and the writing and so forth?
Okay, Sestero went into quite a bit of this in his book. Have you guys read the Disaster Artist book?
I have.
Dude, I did see the movie.
It is a book, so Colin has not read it, but I have in fact read the book, yes.
Okay. Yeah, it's a pretty good book, and he goes into a lot of detail. The nearest that I can figure is that Wiseau came over to America. He was, I believe, from Poland or something, and he eventually landed in New Orleans, and from there he ended up in San Francisco. And he originally started as a street vendor. He would sell these little trinkets and toys in San Francisco. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the area, but right around Pier 39, it's like tourist central. So he was selling little trinkets and stuff. And somehow he got possession of a building where he ended up leasing an office there. And he ended up buying the building somehow back when real estate maybe wasn't that expensive back then.
Was it cheap, 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 cheap?
Thank you. You beat me to the joke. Yeah, it was cheap, 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 cheap. But San Francisco just skyrocketed in value over the years. And somehow, I believe, he ended up with a couple other land holdings where he owned the lease on the buildings right down in the touristy areas. And again, I went to college in that exact area in the 90s, so I know how much money was going through there, and it's like tripled in price since then. So I think he made it all through real estate and just stuff like that. That's my guess.
So is this a twisted tale of the American dream, or how are you meant to take this? Is this meant to be inspiring? Because on some level, if Tommy Wiseau can make it like that, then surely anybody can. But on the other hand, the fact that Tommy Wiseau has hundreds of millions of dollars and I don't is a cause of concern, and that's growing over time.
Yeah. Obviously, we're going to make fun of Tommy Wiseau quite a bit in this podcast. And why wouldn't you? He's basically a catfish. But the thing with him is that he really did make it big. It's like the American dream. And if you hear him talk in interviews, he's like the most patriotic person you've ever heard. Like, I love America. This is the greatest country. A man can change his fortune and make it like all these all these good things happen to him. So like, he's in a very non-ironic way, very, very, very patriotic and pro-American, because I think he really is a success story deep down.
I was going to say, I know lots of people were speculating that maybe he has like ties to the mob or there's some kind of criminal activity. And on a larger scale, the room as a whole was just some money laundering operation that he was not at the forefront of. But I don't know what self-respecting criminal enterprise is going to let Tommy Wiseau be the public face of it. That seems like a risky move, if you ask me.
Yeah, I've heard that stories about it, you know, they're going through the mob ties and selling all these bootleg, like he might have been involved with selling bootleg jackets, but it wasn't so much like it was he was involved with criminal people, as he just had a eye for business and he happened to be right there in Tourist Central where people would buy stuff. So, yeah, I don't think there's necessarily mob ties. I just think, as much as I hate to say it, I think he's a very smart businessman who made some very good investments.
He really has made it. And I think Tommy Wiseau is probably not in a category by himself, but there are, I'm sure, so many people who in Hollywood would gladly trade places with Tommy Wiseau and be well-known and successful based on something that was not initially like well-received. Like, no one's dying for Tommy Wiseau to write their screenplay for them, but they do genuinely, I think at this point, really respect the room as like a piece of art, even when it probably was not produced with the kind of intent that it has ended up with.
It was a passion project. Tommy believed in it and he followed through with it. And you can make the argument he shouldn't have believed in it, but he did. And at a certain level, that's what the movie really gets into, that you have to respect him on a certain level because he just believed in it and went for it. And inexplicably, it worked out. But yeah, it's deep down, it really just was a passion project that he knew would be a hit, maybe not in the way that he expected it to be a hit.
And on the other hand, you can understand the resentment of these up-and-coming directors and writers and these struggling young actors who maybe have moved to LA for the first time and just taking anything they can to try and pay rent for the month, who they see this guy who is completely insane, unlike anyone they've ever met before, who somehow has millions of dollars to just spew away and fire around at this entirely ill-conceived passion project, which somehow makes its way to completion and then years down the line ends up being this cult sensation that somehow you're now proud to be involved with.
Well, yeah, Tommy was at the Oscars this last year. Like, mm-hmm. how can you say he didn't make it when he's literally at the Oscars? And look, he has no talent. He can't act. He can't write. He's got nothing but money and belief in himself, and that's it. And yet somehow he ended up being invited to the Oscars and showing up on stage. So, I mean, that it really turns the whole idea on its head of what makes you a success in the world.
Yeah, I mean, rich white guys failing upwards really is the American dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as we get into the beginning of this movie, we find out, we establish the hell of out of the fact that we're in San Francisco. Got it. And we first see Johnny. We hear his ridiculous speaking voice. We meet his girlfriend, Lisa, his princess for whom he'd do anything. He's bought her this wonderful red dress. And as she's trying it on, this random teen comes through the front door. And I swear to you guys, at this point, I was still thinking to myself, okay, I guess this is some indie movie that's why I haven't heard of it, but this is all going to pay off. There's going to be some interesting dynamics between this 40-year-old guy and 23-year-old girl and 14-year-old kid.
Yeah, that was Leo DiCaprio in a role that will surprise you.
Seriously, that's those were truly the lines along which I was thinking at this point. But it turns out,
how many minutes into the first sex scene did you start to question the artistic integrity of what you were watching?
About 45 seconds. I'm not even kidding. I gave it way too long. It got to the point where it was just uncomfortably dragged out. That I was like, what the hell am I watching? And that's that's right after this scene where we first meet these three characters. Lisa's very grateful for this red dress, and we cue the 90s R&B for the first of many times this movie, and hit the bed for the first of, I believe, three times in the first 25 minutes of this movie. And after about like 45 to 60 seconds is when it finally dawned on me what I was watching, and I had this like flashback to years earlier being on the Arrested Development Wikipedia for an episode. And as you know, they do the awful chicken impression. And I remember reading that it was a reference to some movie that was widely regarded as the worst movie of all time. And that is when it dawned on me, oh my God, that's the movie I'm watching right now.
Yeah, because that's how you want to start your screenplay. You want the hardcore sex scene right at the start. As they introduce the audience.
Three of them in the first half hour, no joke.
And one of them involving Denny, who's a child.
It's tragic to think of how many people have been recommended The Room as a joke and got to, let's say, 20 seconds into that first sex scene and thought they were just being tricked in some tasteless joke into watching some softcore porno, dropped it immediately, never gave it another chance, and now whoever recommended it, I imagine, is tarnished forever in their eyes. They don't know what they're missing out on.
Well, I should point out I've introduced this movie to my kids. I have two teenagers. And right from the start, I tell them, this is a great movie. You're going to love it. It's so unintentionally funny that you're just going to be laughing at how bad it is. But daddy's going to fast forward through the hardcore sex scenes right at the start. We don't need to watch those with my teenagers.
They really drag out. For a movie, I'm going to say, they really drag on. I feel like there are literal softcore pornos that may or may not star Brian Heidick that are shorter than these sex scenes.
Well, after 2 minutes of San Francisco and a solid 5 minutes of navel thrusting, we get to around about the 10-minute mark before anything else finally happens. And I thought, okay, already this is overdoing it before we've even got to the second sex scene. And it shocked me to read in The Disaster Artist that first sex scene was shortened by 3 minutes in the final cut. that somehow this is the abridged version that they managed to convince him to slim down before it made it to air.
Well, yeah, if you read the book, one of the funny things is that was Juliette Danielle, the actress who plays Lisa. That was literally her first day on the set. And basically, this is her introduction to The Room. They say, go on this bed. Tommy's going to leap on you and start pounding the crap out of you. That was her introduction to this movie.
That's wild. And I wanted another thing that we probably should have flagged up earlier. Spoiler alert, we're going to be getting into the details of The Room. So if you haven't seen it and you want to see it unspoiled, come check back in with us later. Obviously, we've gotten through the first couple of minutes. But going forward, the spoiler alert is officially on.
And in case you couldn't get enough of that first sex scene, that same exact footage is spliced into the second sex scene that we get shortly thereafter. As if, I'm not sure what happened in the second one to make it unusable, but I'm not sure how it could be worse than the first one. That somehow is the one they kept going back to.
Well, one thing they didn't really get into in the movie, but they got into the book a lot, is that Tommy was very proud of how ripped he was when he was making this movie, like how muscular he was. And so if there's any shot in the movie where Tommy looks especially, you know, ripped, hot, muscly, he'll just repeat it or use it in the movie, even if it shouldn't be there, just because he thought he looked good. So that explains some of the stuff. He was probably so enamored by that first sex scene and how much you saw his naked ass. He's like, I would like to have more of this later in the movie, and so will the audience.
That also explains a lot of the sleeveless t-shirts later.
Yes, that's the exact scene I'm talking about in the book. I don't know if we want to wait till we get there, but that there's no reason for that scene to be in the movie where they're in the alley and Johnny's got the ripped t-shirt and the where you can see his shoulders. Mm-hmm. And Sestero even says the only reason that scene is in the movie because Tommy thought he looked good and he wanted to put it on screen. There's no reason narratively for that scene to be there.
That's going to be a theme with a lot of other scenes here where there's no real reason narratively for them to be there.
Yeah, I mean, literally you could start this movie and run those establishing opening shots in the credits and then run the closing credits, and it's really just as good a movie, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I have a little more on that later because the Wikipedia does a really good job laying this out, and I want to give a huge shout-out to, I'm sure it's been a collaborative effort, all of the people that have over the years refined the Room Wikipedia. I have read it in its entirety many times over because it is hysterical. As I was saying, as someone who was just like perusing an episode of Arrested Development Wikipedia once, I ended up reading the entire Room Wikipedia as just like a rabbit hole and have done so repeatedly over the years. It is so strong. And I'm sad that there used to be a disclaimer at the top of the Room Wikipedia saying, like, while this is as factual as we can make it, this article is not necessarily written in the same tone as most Wikipedia entries. And unfortunately, that disclaimer is now gone.
Yeah, you can't have the citations needed tag anywhere because it would just have to be attached to everything. Like there's nothing that you can present as the truth. Everything is beyond just truth as a concept. It's transcendent.
What I was going to say is that the reason this movie took off the way it did isn't because of Tommy Wiseau. It's not because of any of the actors or stars. It's really the fans. What the fans made out of this movie is like a masterpiece, a masterclass in just fan interaction. And like you said, the Wikipedia page is just one example. Just if you've seen all the parodies over the years on YouTube, the mashups with Star Wars, the mashups with like Full House, all sorts of crazy things. So I just want to give a huge shout out to anybody who has been a fan of this movie over the years and has built up this fan culture on the internet, because they're the ones who eventually got it to become a book and a movie like it is now.
It's scary to think what Tommy Wiseau's initial marketing campaign would have looked like today in the age of social media. Like, the one thing I want most from this year is for Tommy Wiseau to get on Twitter somehow. That would make my day.
Okay, I will drop a little pearl here that you guys probably don't know. This is one of my favorite trivia things about The Room. Go to the Internet Movie Database and look at the reviews of The Room. If you go chronologically and go back to the first one, I swear the first 10 reviews are all Tommy Wiseau typing under a pseudonym, you can tell. Because it's exactly his little idiot speech that he says. It's the way he talks. It's all like, oh, this movie, so fantastic. The passion, amazing. Tommy Wiseau is young James Dean. Like, it's just him hyping this movie and trying to hype it, and it never happened. And at a certain point in his reviews, you can see when the turn has been made and all of a sudden now it's a comedy. And then he changes his tone and he's like, oh, it's hilarious black comedy from Wiseau Film. Just, it's hilarious to look at it.
So on that, a lot of the co-stars from The Room did a collective AMA on Reddit where they said there was some thread regarding some spin-off or some documentary about The Room from a few years ago where they were getting a lot of criticism on Reddit, and they were quite surprised at how hostile the feedback was until they looked at what the comments actually were and realized that's just Tommy. That he somehow has tracked us down and left comments on that. And when I was looking at some of his other work in preparation for this, and he did a documentary the same year as The Room came out, actually, called Homeless in America, which I will talk about a little bit later, but it's actually surprisingly unironically good. And I wasn't sure how that was received. So I was looking up some reviews for that. There was one review on the database I could find. It was 10 out of 10 by someone who never reviewed another movie again and had a suspiciously poor grasp of English. And I was thinking in the back of my mind, is he just everywhere? Maybe, like, when you see him going to every single screening and always engaging with the fans, and he's responsive to absolutely everything, maybe it's that anything that anybody says about The Room ever, he is keeping track of somehow, and that puts it in a little different light.
Sorry, I really wonder the honest number of times that Tommy Wiseau has watched The Room in its entirety. It's got to be in the thousands by now, right?
I'm sure he sits there and he watches it and he masturbates to it, to be honest. He's so proud of it.
Hey, why not at that point, right?
I mean, that's basically what's on the screen anyway.
With a red dress over himself at some point, I'm sure.
He is so proud of this movie, you can tell. He has never been in on the joke, and that's what made it so amazing for so many years. He just doesn't get it.
We'll talk, I'm sure, in due course about The Disaster Artist, which I think has really taken over and driven the fandom of The Room in recent years. But one reason why I was initially very skeptical of that was it seemed like you have a film like The Room, which can only work as a happy, messy accident. If you try and make a bad film, it doesn't matter how good your writers are, the actors are, how good the director is, you can't intentionally arrive at that. It has to be some byproduct. And so if instead of trying to make a good film and ending up with a hilariously bad film, you're trying to make a good film with a good crew behind it about a book, about a bad film that's trying to be a good film, It's so indirect. You can't really capture the same magic there.
That's true. And I think the critical component in making something that comes across so like magically, like The Room does, is it has to be clear that it was an earnest attempt at making something good that just went horribly awry.
Yeah. Despite what Tommy says now. He will deny that as long as the day is long. But yeah, clearly he had a vision. He thought this was a masterpiece. And again, what the variable that people don't really factor in is that he was rich. So he could throw all these resources. He had state-of-the-art cameras. He had all access to all sorts of stuff that other indie filmmakers wouldn't have. And that's why something like this even made it past the drawing board, just because he had resources.
Didn't he shoot it in two different definitions, yes, like side by side? That's so great.
And not only that, instead of renting the equipment, he just bought everything outright, to the extent that the firm he was renting it from let them use their property to film film the room, because they thought, we have a returns policy here. If this film doesn't get completed, then they're just going to return everything they borrowed. And somehow we need to make sure this just disaster, this walking catastrophe, makes it to completion somehow. So we're just going to give them everything we can and help them, whatever we need to do to help them along, and pray that somehow this staggers across the finish line.
I think you should probably talk more about that, because that is one of the most ridiculous things about this movie, the two camera thing. And I think you might want to explain that to people who aren't aware of this.
Okay, so at the time, most films were recorded in, obviously, just with one camera setup. You'd have 35mm film, or at the time, they were starting to introduce high-definition film as well. And Tommy Wiseau thought, we're going to be breaking new ground here in more than one way. We're going to film this with both at the same time. And that required a crew to handle both of those separately. It meant that you had an entire separate rig on set to handle all of that. And Tommy Wiseau was so scared of something happening to these cameras, which, again, he had brought, unlike any other director in the business, for the express purpose of shooting the room, that he took the HD camera home with him at night and had to take it on to set with him himself, which you think would not be an issue, right? He just turns up with it in his trailer, and I am sure they take some time to set it up and get it going, but beyond that, you'd be fine. Except that he would routinely arrive 3 or 4 hours late to every filming session, so you literally couldn't film anything with both cameras, as explicitly requested by Tommy, if Tommy wasn't there, which he never was. So all of these are just completely asinine and baffling directorial decisions just conspire to make even something like which camera to shoot your film with, which is a trivial decision for anyone else in the business, into some complete horror show of a decision.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He filmed it twice, and at the end, he decided, I like this version more. So he basically threw away an entire filming of his movie and just tossed it. That's the kind of waste he had on this movie.
Yeah, I heard not only, of course, about the two cameras, but Mario, you mentioned earlier that initial sex scene got cut down substantially. And I know I think this was based on like a play he had written or something like, or a book he had written, or something like that was like hundreds and hundreds of pages long, and many things were not able to make it into the final cut that he really wanted, including like a flying car at the end or something like that. What more do we know about what could have been in the room that ended up getting cut, if we know more about that?
Oh, there's a lot in the book. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. It's been a couple of years since I read it. The one that you said is that Johnny was supposed to have a flying car, and at one point it was going to be revealed that Johnny was a vampire. That was the
That's
other
right.
thing. Yeah, I'm trying to think. There's a couple more. I'm sure there was more with Chris R. and Denny. There was much more to that. But yeah, there was some really crazy subplots. And that's again, what I get into, that Johnny had a professional crew around him of people that made movies for a living. And they're telling him, you can't do this. You can't do this. This will not work. We can't film that. And so what we see on the screen is their compromise of what they would allow. Like, this could have been 100 times worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see the film aims for this vibe of, I guess, dark realism, and I say aims because with Tommy Wiseau with the helm, it can never fully get there, but that would have been blown to smithereens if you had this vampire at the helm of a flying car just appearing on a San Francisco rooftop to rescue Denny or something. It doesn't even bear thinking about.
Well, yeah. It's interesting to me in a genuine way that this is based on something he wrote however long ago before going into production in like the early 2000s, and has now at this point spent 15 years, as far as I can tell, doing basically nothing other than things relating to the room. It seems to me like obviously this is written with a pretty blatant message that I'm sure we'll talk through later about Tommy feeling like everyone in his life is essentially just betraying him constantly. It seems like Tommy Wiseau sincerely must feel some part of that himself. Like, he really does love this story, and that it's resonating with so many people, regardless of what level it's resonating on.
Yeah. Also, there's a very subtle subplot that Tommy Wiseau may have a problem with women. It's very subtle. You have to squint to see it.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say that I don't think this was actually a play, you know, years before. If I remember from the book, he's decided one day he'd been rejected. He was trying to star as an actor, wanted to make it in Hollywood, and everyone rejected him. And he just basically sat down and one day and said, "Ah, I have money. I'll make my own movie." And he just sat down and pounded out a script, which clearly was based on a lot of pain in his life. Like, there was some woman that betrayed him at some point, as you will see repeatedly in this movie, as that happens to Johnny.
Do you think so, Mario? Is that something that you think you might be able to read into?
I mean, I don't have an English degree, so I'm not entirely sure about that. It's kind of subtle, but I think he just pounded out the script based on his real life experience. But I don't believe it was actually a script floating around for years before he filmed it.
Yeah, there was one scene which I think people have picked up on as autobiographical when he alludes to he arrived in town with a check that he couldn't cash and he had to work his way up. And I think Greg Sestero said in The Disaster Artist that according to the history of Tommy Wiseau that he got from the man himself, so take it for what it's worth, that was his version of events, that he had the check that he couldn't cash and he had to, he was scrambling around to find a place to sleep and to find a job and so on. And you kind of see hints of that at work in the movie. And it makes you wonder what other stuff that isn't explicitly tied to him has some reference in his own life. So is Denny meant to be some like surrogate child or something, and is Greg that in real life? Like, you can kind of connect the threads in a way that looks more and more unsettling the further you go along that line.
Yeah, I'm really not sure how deeply I want to unpack the idea of what real life experience the character of Denny was drawn from.
Well, again, if you know the book, there's some pretty surprising detail in there about Tommy's life. And I don't want to bring down the podcast too much, but he apparently had a really sad life, like orphaned and like beaten up and abused and stuff. So he has a really sad life story. And what I think they really get into in the movie, they try to basically say that Tommy showed up in L.A. and he just wanted to be accepted. He wanted to be an actor, but he had the language issue and he looks funny. I mean, there's no way around it. He just looks weird. And so he was never able to make it as an actor. And he basically projected all his thoughts and dreams onto this guy, Greg Sestero, who he kind of saw as a younger version of him. He's like, this guy's going to make it. He's good looking. This is what I could be if I was an actor. And so it's almost in like a Talented Mr. Ripley type of way, almost kind of creepy, that he kind of lives through Sestero. And this is the tone that comes out through the book quite a bit.
And you make that comparison not just because you have a million different movie references to hand at all times, but that's something which Tommy Wiseau was explicitly obsessed with. And Greg mentions that if you're familiar with both, you can see the echoes of The Talented Mr. Ripley in the room wherever you look.
Yeah, one of my favorite tidbits from the Wikipedia was that Mark was supposed to be named after Matt Damon, who was one of the stars of The Talented Mr. Ripley, but Tommy Wiseau misheard the name, so he called him Mark instead. I don't even know if that's true, but that is hysterical.
That sounds right. Yeah, that sounds correct. I think that is true.
Well, I think it's clear what would draw Tommy Wiseau in real life to someone he views as like a protege or a younger version of himself if he could have been in a better situation as an actor. But what did Greg say about why he was ultimately willing to be so complicit with Tommy? Because as you mentioned, it seemed like no one else was really willing to accept him in any capacity, as far as I can tell. What made Greg overlook so much and be willing to do that?
Yeah, I don't want to speak for him, but what I recall from the book is basically that Greg really had no other things going on. He was a struggling young actor. He was getting nothing, no work whatsoever. And this guy said, please be in this movie. I wrote it. And they were like roommates at the time. So Greg was like, all right, I'll be in your movie. He didn't want to hurt the guy's feelings. And Greg's thought was always that no one will ever see this piece of crap. It's just a thing I'm doing for this guy as a favor. So I don't think he ever just realized it would go to the extent that it did. I think he thought he was doing something nice for his crazy, eccentric roommate.
And if you read the answers given by the other cast members in that AMA, they basically all say the same thing, that I realized the first moment I arrived on set, or the first moment I read my part of the script, because again, no one ever had access to the full script. They only got their own parts, and sometimes they didn't even get all of their own parts. They were just directed to do whatever Tommy told them while they were on the stage. As soon as they got any exposure to the film at all, they knew that it was just a complete hot mess. But what were they going to do? They were a struggling actor. They didn't have any credits to their name. They didn't have any money to their name. They needed something. Yeah. So this was the best they could find, which is a depressing reflection on the state of Hollywood, I guess. But also it shows you why anyone was willing to do this at all. And there wasn't just some mass mutiny after day one.
And again, it cannot be stated enough that no one thought this would ever see the light of day.
Yeah, that's probably a fair counterpoint that I'd never really considered, because it really, I've wondered, like, who on earth was willing to do this? And you hear the behind the scenes stuff about him going through like thousands of people in casting and wondering how these people ended up, as far as I was ever concerned, like so unlucky as to be forever associated first and foremost, if not exclusively, with this movie. But that does make sense that, you know, in 2002 or whenever this was being filmed, I'm sure they were just doing it for the paycheck.
Yeah, and there's a great quote from Chris Rock, famous comedian, who said, "The biggest jump in a person's career is from having nothing to having something. If you can make that jump, then the jump from something to being rich or successful is not actually as big. It's the jump from nothing to something that's the big one."
So at this point, we've met Johnny and Lisa, two of our leads. We've met Denny, the random youth who's going to be popping in and out from time to time. And after this, we meet what I think at this point, I've seen the room three or four times now. I'm willing to call this next person my favorite character in the room. We meet Lisa's mom, Claudette, another one of the most subtle characters in the movie. I'm so willing to call Claudette my MVP here, where she comes over for a heart-to-heart with Lisa about what's going on in her daughter's life. And Lisa's explaining how she doesn't love Johnny anymore and he's too boring. But Claudette is not hearing any of this. And she says, "Hey, you guys have known each other for 5 years," although later they talk about having known each other for 7 years, but I guess neither here nor there. They're engaged at this point, and hey, he's got a great job. So Lisa, I, as your mother, am officially here to tell you, your hands are tied.
I love that you actually could pick someone out as the MVP of this movie, because what's great is that everybody will pick a different character. I wasn't sure, were you going to go Denny? Were you going to go
Chris R?
Mark, the me underwears guy, just it's crazy. I have to point this out as a verbal linguist. I study language. I pay attention to language. This movie is a cornucopia of verbal quirks and just weird ways of people saying things. And it's obviously because Tommy Wiseau doesn't really speak the strongest English, and it's clearly written in his voice. And people have said this movie is like, it's like an alien came down and wrote a movie of what they thought human beings were like. That's literally what this movie is. Nobody talks correctly. They use weird phrasing, but some of the verbal quirks.
Yeah, it's like
here,
Google Translate got put from one language to another.
Yeah, but the verbal quirks, I want to point out that Tommy loves to laugh at the end of a sentence. That's his punctuation at the end of a sentence. "Lisa's my darling." Like, he always does his little laugh. And Claudette does something similar where she says, at the end of every sentence. Like, "Why don't you love Johnny? Like, you can't support yourself. She does this weird little thing.
I will, in all sincerity, make the case for Claudette, because I think she is genuinely one of the more talented actors on the movie. And you can debate to what extent she is more or less hamstrung by what she's given than the other actors are, but I think she actually is pretty solid, and she is not some of these struggling young 20-somethings who are just taking whatever part is handed to them. She was, I think, retired at this point. She was pursuing acting as a hobby, and she apparently would drive in 2 hours each way every single day to be part of filming, and it took its toll on her at times. She was taken to the hospital for heatstroke at one point, but she very quickly just sprang back up again and came back and resumed filming. So she really wanted to be there, and she brought a level of enthusiasm and just positivity to the experience that somehow survived everything that Tommy Wiseau could throw at her.
Yeah, it's interesting because professionalism, she was, you know, heads and tails above Tommy. It's interesting because I have been on the fence for years if I think the lady who played Claudette was a good actress, because sometimes I agree with you. Oh, she's clearly trying her best with this dialogue. She's doing the best she can. And then other times, like when my wife watched this, she's like, "Claudette is the worst. That is the worst actress out of all of them." And that's saying something. So I'm on the fence with Claudette. It's hard for me to judge her.
We are grading on a curve.
Wife,
yeah.
So with anyone to disagree with their wife.
Yeah. No, there's two actors in this that give off any sense of competence and professionalism. And I always say it's Michelle and Chris R. Those are the only two that I kind of actually buy a little bit as human beings.
Chris R really makes the most of his 25 seconds on the screen. He really brings that to life.
Yeah.
He's strong.
But we should get back to the actual film itself now. And one of the most iconic scenes in it here is Johnny's car slowly and methodically pulls up outside a San Francisco flower shop, where this is one of the things that immediately jumps out. The scene itself, he his car just pulls up outside. He slowly gets outside. He takes a nice scenic stroll up to the front door and walks in. That by itself takes longer than all of the dialogue in the scene put together. And so as soon as he gets to the front counter, it's like, oh, wait, we've already spent far too much time on this. And everything else, it's like it's been accelerated in post-production. It's all zoomed up. All the lines run together. It's a complete mess. And the fun behind the scenes tidbit here is that the flower shop lady tells Johnny that he's her favorite customer, even though she didn't recognize him somehow. She's not an actor. She was just the owner of a flower shop, and they decided to hire that location for the day. And it's always fun when you hear those stories to try and work out which people in this film are not actors, which people are aspiring actors but clearly not very good at it, and which of them are genuinely talented but somehow, you know, they're struggling to make ends meet and they just have to take whatever they're given. So, those boundaries aren't so clear sometimes.
I was going to say the story's actually even better than that. It's, I remember from the book that was a real filming location in San Francisco. It's one of the few scenes they shot there. And Tommy Wiseau never got a permit to film there. He's like, we'll just show up at a flower shop, bring in the cameras and shoot for 15 seconds. And that's why that scene is so fast, because they had no time to rehearse or anything. It's not blocked. It's literally just him putting down the camera, walking in, doing the dialogue and getting out before the cops can show up.
That's funny. Is it actually her doggy?
No, I think the dog was CGI. He's Industrial Light and Magic. Yes, that was her dog.
Yeah, supposedly it was her dog. And it wasn't meant to be in the scene initially, of course, but it was just lying there on the counter. And when Tommy went up to introduce himself, he asked, is that dog real? Even though it was there looking at him, moving around. He somehow, that was up for debate. He just wanted to make sure before you're doing his dues as a professional before moving on.
I was recently at my parents' house, and they have two golden retrievers, and I walked in the door not thinking anyone was nearby, and one of the dogs came up, and I let out a loud, oh, hi, doggy, and my mom was in the kitchen right next door and was like, what the hell did you just say?
Oh, hi, Colin, I didn't know it was you. You're my favorite son.
Yeah.
We really should have got her in here, too. This would have been a real missed opportunity.
I don't think we should have done that. I don't think she's a big Tommy Wiseau fan yet. Although, I think my mom might have actually seen The Disaster Artist. I think she may have mentioned that offhand. So maybe, Dom, that dream can become a reality someday.
I hope so. But let's actually touch on that, because there are lots of people now who...
No, we're not. We're done talking about my mom now, Don. Okay? So
we're done when I say we're done, okay? There are many people who have come to the room recently as a result of hearing about it through The Disaster Artist, and they've seen that film first, and so that's going to calibrate their expectations in advance. Do you think that's a healthy way to go into the film? Because you see Tommy Wiseau being portrayed by James Franco, and so when you see the real thing, it doesn't have the same sense of novelty to it, and because you've seen that very outlandish character already, you're left thinking that's a real Tommy Wiseau and this is just some imitation, when in reality it's Tommy Wiseau just somehow is a real human being and everything else is just some pale attempt to imitate him.
Yeah, it's see, that's a tough question, and it's something I've thought of quite a bit. Do I think The Disaster Artist was good for the room or bad? I mean, obviously, it introduced a bunch of new people. It made, you know, the Sestero and all these people into stars, and now they have a second career where they're like a big deal. But, like, if you were a fan of this movie before The Disaster Artist, I think you're probably a little disappointed at what the fan base has turned into at this point, where so many people are in on the joke, and they, you know, we love Tommy. He was hilarious. We love him, and we're in the room. When the truth is, Tommy Wiseau, in truth, is kind of a dick in real life, and he's not the nicest guy, and I've heard all sorts of stories about people that hated working with him and how he's constantly slapping lawsuits and injunctions on people that say bad things about his movie. So I'm not 100% thrilled that The Disaster Artist came out, to be honest, because I liked the fan base a little more before that, to be honest.
Do we need to lawyer up after this podcast?
We may have to. Let's check with our legal advisors after this one, because he is known for being very litigious, which is surprising for someone that you think would be in on the joke. But again, he just isn't. He's kind of a dick, like I said.
And you see some of that in The Disaster Artist, but even that was a very sanitized portrayal, which had to be run by Tommy Wiseau before anything could make it to air. So if you read the book, Tommy Wiseau comes across as not even someone you can ironically take enjoyment in. He's just a dick to everybody around him, and especially the people he's working with. He's borderline abusive at times and sometimes crosses that border. So it's no surprise that you see various members of the production crew either being fired or just quitting abruptly. There are various members of the cast itself who try to weasel their way out at times and only stay in because of some sense of sunk cost. And we're close to the end, so maybe we can make our way through it. And the more you read about it, the more you wonder if this is something that you can really enjoy without having those same reservations. And that's the issue, I think, for me, that I can enjoy Tommy Wiseau as some just absurd character that's on my TV screen. But when you understand that he is a real person who, by virtue of whatever weird personality flaws he has, treats people in real life that same way too, it starts to look a little more suspect.
Yeah, it's just a fine line. And now you have, you know, James Franco, someone very charming and charismatic playing him. And that's not really what Tommy is. But people think of Tommy Wiseau, they think of James Franco now, and it's really kind of softened the image. Although my wife,
after the last year of James Franco news.
Well, okay. Well, that's a whole different story. But yeah, just compared to what Wiseau like was before, he was like this weird mutant. And now he's a fun, charming, weird mutant, which, again, was not probably the reality at the time. And like I was about to say, my wife was actually kind of shocked that Wiseau even allowed The Disaster Artist to be made, because it takes some digs at him that he does not let other people take digs at him in some of these regards. So it's kind of interesting how much of The Disaster Artist was actually okayed by Tommy, or how much of, you know, the studio's legal department just told him, we're going to make this and you can bluster and do all you want, but we're going to make this whether you like it or not. So it's kind of interesting to know what the dynamic was there.
And that change in the fan base, to what extent do you think that's just what any subculture or any fan base undergoes over time, where initially it's a small group of very devoted fans who they have their in jokes, they know all the lore, they know everything that's going on, and then when whatever it is they're a fan of goes mainstream, which in theory is a success, that's what you want to happen, you get these people coming in who don't have that same understanding and who maybe are less attached to it, who don't have the same frame of reference for it. And there's this, this snobbery or this culture clash between those two different groups of fans. And you see that, I mean, you see it in the Survivor fan base, certainly, but you see it basically everywhere. Do you think it's something more than that, or is this just the same story that we've seen play out time and time again?
I mean, can we use the word casuals? Is that a profanity? Can
absolutely.
We use that word? Okay. Well, in my opinion, and I'm just one guy talking about this, I think the room phenomenon was over like a decade ago. And so when The Disaster Artist revived it and brought it to the mainstream, it's kind of weird to me, because to me, the whole era of this movie had passed. This was over. Like, everyone lived through this. We laughed at how funny it was. We made a big deal. We made the jokes. You know, we laughed at the spoons and all the little references in the movie. And so it's weird for it to come back later, 7 or 8 years later, and like now your grandma knows about it and she's quoting the room, which is weird that it has gone to that level. So I understand. Completely agree there's a fair bit of snobbery involved, but I can't help it. I have such attachment to this room, to this movie, and the culture that developed organically around it, that now it seems a little artificial and thrown together for mainstream purposes.
Yeah, so on Staff Picks, you talk about movies which have not really received the attention that maybe they should, or which, I guess in the same vein as The Room, are so bad that they deserve that kind of attention just to expose how absurd they truly are. And if you were doing this 15 years ago, The Room would have been a great candidate for that. But
oh, yeah.
Now here in 2018, this came about because I saw you were listing the roster for the upcoming episodes, and I said, would you consider doing The Room at some point, even though it doesn't really fit with that same mission statement? And as you said, the time for that has really come and gone. And if we're talking about it now, it's in a completely different context, where it's as a standalone thing, and it's not going to be in those lists of 100 underrated movies or 100 cult classics you need to go and see, because it really has transcended that, and it did many years ago now.
Yeah, too. I just want to sum that up, what Dom just said. We didn't introduce at the start. I run another podcast called Staff Picks, which is about underrated movies that I just think need a little more attention in the world. And Dom specifically had mentioned it to me. Do you want to do The Room? And I'm like, I couldn't say that movie's underloved anymore with a straight face. Like, at this point, it's overloved. Like, it kind of needs to go away for a while and let people rediscover it. So yeah, it's in a whole different category than it used to be.
How do you reconcile that attitude with being the host of a podcast that you hope people will listen to, where if enough people do, now those movies aren't underrated anymore, and your sense of purpose has to melt away a bit.
It's crazy. My self-identity is wrapped up in this. You've put me into a quagmire I can't escape. Thank you, Dom.
But yeah, it's kind of like Survivor. Inception.
Yeah,
it's like the funny 115. You build up seasons like Vanuatu, and now I think Worlds Apart is the new one, where people, it's becoming so underrated that now you're making it overrated.
Yeah, it's, again, with the podcast, Staff Picks is a whole different thing. I just want people to know about movies that I've grown up with that are obscure. And again, I have to throw a couple in there that everyone knows, like Galaxy Quest, just to cleanse the palate every so often and keep the listenership up. But the bread and butter of that show is movies that maybe I just saw once when I was 12 on cable and it lodged in my memory. I just wanted to revisit it and tell people about it. So it's, yeah, that's the thing. If these movies become too popular, then they're not underrated anymore. So I think I just disappear at that point. I cease to exist.
Yeah, I haven't read, just before we move too quickly off of it, I haven't read The Disaster Artist, which I'm sure is shocking news to regular listeners, but I did see the movie. It sounds to me like both of you guys saw the movie as well. Mm-hmm. And while I'm with you that I think it may have, maybe sullied is the wrong word, but like oversaturated kind of the Room fan base, at least for the time being, I did enjoy the movie quite a bit, and particularly I thought James Franco did a good job as pretending to be like acting as Tommy Wiseau. What did you guys think about that? You know, setting aside whatever allegations may exist at this point and be the more important James Franco issue. I thought Tommy Wiseau is a very difficult character to get away with an entire movie without people really seeing you as an actor trying to play Tommy Wiseau, but he was really good as far as I was concerned. What did you guys think about that and just the movie overall?
I love the movie. I loved every single minute of that movie. It was fun. It spelled out some of the greatest parts of the book. And the end credits in particular, where they show the reenacted scenes they filmed for The Disaster Artist next to the real ones from The Room. I mean, I would recommend that to any person who has ever enjoyed anything in cinema. Just watch those two back to back and watch how they were recreated and how good they were. So, yeah, I thought the movie was fantastic. I loved every minute of it.
Yeah, so for me, it's weird seeing James Franco get all of these plaudits now, because I always understood him as just this nuisance who was always there but never really receiving credit for anything or never really held in high regard for his acting ability. And so for this to be the role which catapulted him into that upper echelon now is bizarre. And I don't know if it's even a compliment to say you're very good at portraying Tommy Wiseau, but you're so convincing in getting into that character. But he is, and he does a great job of it. Less so Dave Franco as Greg, but we can ignore that. That's we can pass that by.
How dare you? I love Dave Franco.
I had the issue that I brought up before, where I can appreciate The Room because, as Colin suggested, it is an earnest attempt at making a good movie that falls horribly flat. Whereas this, it's, I don't know if it's trying to mock The Room or appreciate The Room or be its own thing with reference to The Room, but still be critically acclaimed in its own right. And I think the movie itself takes a while to find its own voice in that regard. But I will echo what you said, Mario, about those ending scenes, where if you haven't seen The Room before and you're watching this because you're the James Franco fan out there and you just want to, you want to get a piece of the action, you see this and you think, I'm not sure if this movie is convincing. What they're showing here can't possibly be real. And then you see them just in parallel, side by side, and your mind is blown. It's like, yeah, well, actually, if anything, they were underselling it. they didn't prepare me well enough for what I'm about to see.
Yeah, again, I think it's just really well done. And like you said, some of the actors might not be perfect for the part, but in the bigger picture, just the people that I always feel bad for when I think of The Room and the whole phenomenon is people like Juliet Danielle, who played Lisa, and some of the actors that had to go through hell. And like to this day, Juliet Danielle still doesn't like talking about it because you go to screenings and people out there talking about how fat she is. And to this day, they're still laughing and mocking, not realizing that was a real actress who maybe had body issues, maybe was very sensitive about that. So when I see the movie getting all this goodwill and all this attention now, and maybe you see how horrible Tommy was to some of his actors, those are the people I really empathize with, the Juliet Danielles of the world who really went through hell, and maybe there was a silver lining at the end that maybe people understand what she went through. So that's how I kind of look at it in the big picture.
And those comments, obviously, they hurt coming from anyone, but they hurt especially coming from Tommy Wiseau on set, which is what she had to go through at the time. Because so she's there on one of her first real acting jobs, on her first day filming, being told to strip down for this bizarre sex scene where Tommy Wiseau is just getting way too up close and personal, and also in the process making these comments about her body in front of everyone there on set, which she said at the time and in her AMA 15 years later, that really stuck with her and scarred her for a long time. And that's one of those examples where it's harder to laugh at those scenes where Tommy is just aiming at her belly button somehow, knowing what was actually going on in order to make that artistic content.
Yeah, there's a lot of things in this movie that are a little harder to laugh at when you know the backstory behind them. And I will just even say something else. Again, I mentioned it before, I don't like to bring the podcast down, but in the book, it's alleged by a Sestero a couple times that Tommy Wiseau was in some really bad car accidents, like life or death car accidents where he was in a coma. And there's a very real chance that he had brain damage from these car accidents. And it kind of maybe explains some of his behaviors, some of his thought processes, why he's just not really with it and just not really there all the time. And it makes it a little less funny to laugh at him when you realize this could just be this passion play of a brain damaged guy.
What do we make of
horrible?
What do we make of Greg Sestero as a whole then? Because in comparison to Tommy Wiseau, you obviously have this good cop, bad cop thing going on. And when you stack the two of them up as people or as actors or really on any other metric, obviously Greg Sestero comes out of that. But in his own right, is he actually that compelling as an actor, as a character and so on? Or is it just that he's somehow been swept up into this maelstrom with Tommy Wiseau? And because he is a generally normal functioning human being, by default, he ends up looking pretty good.
Yeah, he's the voice of reason, the one voice of reason that could tell the story. So I think he just kind of fell ass backwards right into this fortuitous event where this is his thing now. I'm the biographer of Tommy Wiseau.
Well, has he been getting more work now? Is anyone interested in the Greg Sestero business now? Or is he still basically a professional The Room viewing party attending?
I mean, I haven't seen a lot of Greg Sestero movies lately. Have you?
I sure haven't, but I you know, hopefully some.
Yeah, I don't think it's really affected his career much, other than, like you said, he is now a professional Room survivor.
Yeah, the one movie that I've seen from him involved Tommy Wiseau, so I think he hasn't fully moved on from that. And the past 15 years of his career now have been defined by his role in this. And in The Disaster Artist, he's trying to give a reasonably honest account of the whole experience. And I imagine he and Tommy would disagree about a lot of the stuff that he describes in there, but you get the sense that he is also looking out for Tommy's reputation and the reputation of The Room as a whole. And if he was completely over it and he thought his life was miserable and he was looking for any escape from being defined by The Room and having this still take over his life, I'm not sure how vocal he would be about that either in there or elsewhere. So it's hard to get a sense of how he truly feels, on top of Greg just as a person by all accounts being fairly laid back, fairly reserved, and not really wanting to make these public criticisms unless he absolutely has to.
Yeah, I think it's all been very cathartic to him, and I think through it being cathartic for him, it's been cathartic for all the other people who survived The Room, and I think he's really looking out for them. Like you said, he's looking out for Tommy's reputation and the movie's reputation, but he's really doing it for, you know, Robin Paris, Juliet Danielle, Dan Kirkjian, I forget his name, but all the other actors who had to live with the stigma of being in The Room. And I think, from what I hear, he's very well respected and beloved by his co-stars just because he's the one person that kind of gives this movie the small shred of dignity it ever could have had.
Yeah, I think I generally find It Is What It Is to be an extremely vapid response to pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. But in this exact scenario, I think if you're Greg Sestero, you kind of just have to say, there's no taking that back. I might as well embrace this and do as much good with this as I can for myself and everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
So at the one screening of The Room that I had the good fortune to attend, where Tommy and Greg were there in attendance, signing autographs and so on, I was trying to observe Greg as they were being mobbed by the fans and having these T-shirts thrust at them and everything else. And I couldn't tell if he was just weary with the world and wanted all of this to be over as soon as possible, or if that's just how he looks and that's his general demeanor. And actually, this is what he loves doing, and he wouldn't make any other choice if he had his way.
So setting aside Dom stalking Greg Sestero all night for at least the time being, some major plot points have been developing here in this movie. In the first 25 minutes, as I mentioned, we have three different sex scenes with Lisa, the first and third of which are with Johnny. The second is with Mark, and that's quite a plot twist there. Johnny's best friend suddenly now with Lisa. And the third time, as I mentioned, is with Johnny again, and she gets him drunk this time, even though he tends to not drink alcohol. Mario, you alluded to the real subtlety that I think separates Tommy Wiseau from most screenwriters, and I think these bed scenes and the events leading up to them are great examples of this, where particularly one thing that really stood out to me that I loved, the song that was playing during her scene with Mark was about how you're a rose to me. And we'll recall that Johnny showed up with roses for her and goes to the flower shop and littered the bed with rose petals. There's a lot of really significant stuff here that less astute viewers are not going to be picking up on, Mario.
Yeah. Okay. And again, more examples of Wiseau being subtle, how in many movies, the male and female will slowly lower to the bed. And you know, they're probably going to have sex. But Tommy Wiseau, no, he wants to drive the point home, because we need at least 25 thrusts. Then we'll know, they're having sex, because we'll literally watch them dry hump for 30 seconds. So
it's like the Hoosiers five-pass rule. You got to pass it five times before you can score.
Don't get caught watching the paint dry, son.
That's right. Yeah.
I just threw Dom off with a sports reference.
Yeah, that's right. I would love it if Dom could even begin to tell us what Hoosiers were.
I was too mesmerized at the thought of Tommy Wiseau rhythmically thrusting his way. But luckily, I can wash those images out of my mind. We can move on swiftly to something else before the next sex scene here. And I believe the next scene is we have another powwow between Lisa and Claudette, and it's striking that when Lisa reveals for the first time this big revelation that Johnny hit her when he was drunk, Claudette's first thought wasn't, oh my god, what just happened? It's, Johnny doesn't drink. How and the idea that he might is so outside the realm of possibility that we can't even get to step two, where there's actual domestic violence involved. We gotta stay on track here.
Yeah, as far as Claudette is concerned, it seems like even if he did hit her, that's neither here nor there as far as she should be considering him as her future husband.
And how dare you impugn his honor by suggesting that he might enjoy a tipple from time to time.
Yeah. I was going to say, classic Tommy Wiseau screenwriting. He uses the domestic violence subplot just as a segue into a story about that jerk Harold.
That's right. Her pesky, Claudette's pesky brother, who it seems like out of the kindness of his heart just gave her a house a long time ago that has substantially increased in value, and he's not getting a dime, that motherfucker.
Yeah, Wiseau is not strong with the subplots. This is exhibit A right here.
Harold has more character development than half the people who actually appear on screen throughout the movie, and he really makes an impression. But between this weird attitude towards alcohol and the outrage when Denny is some part-time druggie later, I'm wondering if this is some like say no to drugs thing from the 80s that just got canned and then just revived from a vault somewhere that was abolished for being too over the line.
Yeah, Mark is up there smoking a joint as he's throwing Peter off the roof. It's very strong, like Reagan-era ad campaigning.
So this is from an earlier Wiseau script?
Yeah, that's right.
This is a
holdover.
Tommy Wiseau and the CIA in concert to keep the kids of America safe.
Well, in this this so-called powwow, which is a great term for this meeting between Lisa and Claudette, we also get the bombshell dropped on us that the results are in, and the doctor says she definitely has breast cancer. So this is going to be one of many things that never is addressed again at any point later on in the movie. And I'm going to read from the Wikipedia, because this is one of my favorite sections. And it also touches on something that one of you also just referenced. So this is really strong stuff. So here we go. Quote, in addition to being rife with continuity errors, the film has several plots, subplots, and character details whose inconsistencies have been commented on by critics and the audiences. The Portland Mercury has stated that a number of plot threads are introduced, then instantly abandoned. In an early scene, halfway through a conversation about planning a birthday party for Johnny, Claudette offhandedly tells Lisa, quote, I got the results of the test back. I definitely have breast cancer, end quote. The issue is casually dismissed and never revisited during the rest of the film. Similarly, the audience never learns the details surrounding Denny's drug-related debt to Chris R. or what led to their confrontation on the roof. And beyond being Johnny's friend, Mark's background receives no exposition. When he's first introduced, he claims to be, quote, very busy while sitting in a parked car in the middle of the day, with no explanation ever given to his occupation or what he was doing.
Ah, just beautiful. Yeah, well, you forget when Claudette reveals that she has breast cancer. This is where we learn that Lisa has apparently been through medical school and has advanced medical training, mm-hmm. because she tells her mother, A, don't worry about it. And the other
that
one
seems
is
to work. Every single time that she uses it.
Yeah, that is a oft-repeated catchphrase. Don't worry about it. That's how Tommy Wiseau ends the scene. Don't worry about it. But the other one is that Lisa tells her mother, don't worry, they're curing lots of people every day. So there you go. If you get breast cancer, that should help you sleep a little better at night.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mark thing is interesting, too, because everybody in the movie, there's a sense of urgency that just underlies the whole thing. Everybody always has to be somewhere. They're always very busy. They have to go. It's unclear what they have to go to, unless they're all meeting up secretly away somewhere to conspire against Johnny, which I guess is what he believes.
I'm just don't worry about it.
just so many little things that pop out at you when you watch this movie over and over. Like, that's literally the way that Wiseau writes scenes. He opens a scene with a character opening a door, walking into a room and being greeted. And then they'll say what they have to say. And then they'll say, I have to go. And they leave and someone says goodbye to them. That is literally like every scene in this movie. That's how he thinks dialogue is done in movies.
It's very natural and organic, Mario. I don't think a writer like you at your level would understand yet.
Exactly. I would not have the capacity to imagine that characters would greet each other by first name every single time they see them.
How many international viewing parties are people having for you? That's all I need to know.
Okay, well, you threw out subplots that never get resolved. Here's my favorite. This one probably doesn't get mentioned in Wikipedia. There's a scene where Denny walks over to their house and asks to borrow a cup of sugar and some butter and some... Like, is he fucking baking? And then she's like, I don't have it.
It's like a hastily thrown together excuse once he realized someone else was at the place.
Is the little homeless druggie baking today? Is this like the next master chef? He's junior master chef over there?
I'm not sure where he's going to keep them either. It reminds me of the Hank Scorpio scene where he just like brings the sugar and the cream out of his suit pockets. It never gets resolved, but by this point, you're not expecting it to. You just think, oh, well, that's slightly strange, and then you just move on to the next thing. And because nothing ever gets resolved, you're not expecting anything will. It's a remarkable overturning of any conventional storytelling rules.
Yeah, I think the strangest thing about Denny to me is people who do a lot of drugs and people who wear rugby shirts, that Venn diagram is two separate circles. There is zero overlap in that community, in those communities.
I also love that Denny's supposed to be like 15, 16 years old, and he's played by a guy who's like 30. So you have no idea who this character is. Yeah, he's like one of the oldest actors in the cast, Philip Haldeman.
I had no idea.
Would you trust Tommy Wiseau to find a child actor? Because that's not going anywhere good,
let
me tell you.
I thought he was like 22 or whatever. I didn't know he was in his 30s.
Oh, yeah, he's older than me. He's got like gray hair now. He looks like one of the Wizard of Oz munchkins these days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Philip Haldeman, whose name is misspelled in the opening credits as a final indignity.
Yeah, and even worse, we never saw the scene where he's making his bundt cake over in his apartment.
Yeah.
It's a double whammy.
Well, we do get a great Denny scene. I would say that's like the next big highlight of this movie is Denny up on the roof, which is going to be the setting for pretty much the remainder or most of the back half of the movie. There's a lot of rooftop action going on, and this is where it kicks off. Denny's up there dribbling a basketball around, no hoop in sight, just for the record. And this rugged looking character that we've referenced a couple times named Chris R. comes up. He somehow has rooftop access at Johnny's house as well. And he's asking Denny, hey, man, where are you going to have my money? It turns out Denny's in pretty deep here to this guy, which for reasons that we'll later find out are drug related, as we've been alluding to. But this is one of the most fun scenes in the movie while we're on the topic of things that just never get resolved again. Chris R., a one and done character with this scene, but we referenced long ago in this podcast at this point, one of the low key MVPs of the movie as well, with his black tank top and his black beanie, just showing up with apparently enough motivation to potentially kill Denny over whatever is going on here. He puts a gun to Denny's head, but thankfully the scene is broken up when Lisa and Claudette arrive, and that terrifies Chris R., and he runs away.
Yeah. Well, and also Johnny and Mark wrestle him down.
That's because true these two as apparently well, yeah.
have Greco-Roman wrestling training. They can take down a hitman.
It's unclear how Chris or really anybody else has that rooftop access, because when you look at how they actually enter the scene, you have this corrugated shed thing, this outpost that represents the I guess the stairwell is meant to be. But when you look at the angle, they kind of go into it and they turn left, but left doesn't exist in the context of where that is on the roof. It's like they're walking through the wall and then out into thin air and just dropping out off the side.
It's like Wile E. Coyote. It's like they don't look down, they won't fall.
Well, that's the thing. If you actually had Johnny in this movie saying meep meep, it actually would have fit with his character. So they could have included the Wile E. Coyote subplot.
Oh, I screwed it up. It was, yeah. Who is it who falls? Is it Roadrunner or Wile E. Coyote?
It's the coyote. The Roadrunner never falls because okay. he's the good guy.
That's right. Okay, good. I didn't screw it up.
Now, can I drop some Chris R. trivia on you? This is one of my favorite
Please
parts
do.
Of this movie.
Please.
The actor who played Chris R. is some guy who had never acted before. They just told him he's
oh,
like
really?
Some friend of
you
Sestero.
Can't tell.
Yeah, he's not. But oh, yeah, I was going to say there's really two actors in this movie who even have the barest semblance of competence. That's Chris R. and Michelle. We haven't really talked about her yet. But Chris R. was not a real actor. He was basically just some big, scary dude that Sestero and Tommy and John and Tommy Wiseau knew. And they said, come on and play a drug dealer. And so that was his motivation. He's just a big, scary guy who's scaring the crap out of this little Philip Haldeman. And that's why it comes off so real in film, because that's what the guy was just really like. He was just big and intense and mean, and it comes off great on screen. So he's not even acting there.
I like to think that that guy has settled back into a peaceful life as an accountant or something, and his one IMDb credit is just as Chris R. on the room 15 years ago, and that's he'll forever live in notoriety. But luckily here, the question of rooftop access never really comes up, because roof has several pairs of inverted commas around it. As it turns out, this is not an actual factual roof. This is a set that they put up in the parking lot of a building that has a roof on it, where they could have filmed instead, and where they decided to set up a green screen so that they could capture the skyline, which you might say defeats the point of using a green screen when you had the skyline right there that you could film instead. But we're not Tommy Wiseau. We're not on his level. We can't question his choices. But it really stands out that this green screening is not seamless. So when the camera is abruptly jumping about from all of these different angles, you see the skyline just slowly undulating in the background. It's it's like you're in some weird fantasy dream sequence.
Well, as also I'm someone who spent several years working in TV with a green screen. Lisa's hair in particular is getting lost in that green screen all over the place. Like giant chunks of her hair are just going invisible in certain points.
Lisa, you're invisible. No, but yeah. The thing with the green screen that's hilarious is that Wiseau wanted to set a movie in San Francisco because that's his home city. That's where his life story took place. So the movie's filmed in L.A., but they had to pretend it was San Francisco because it was so important. It must be filmed on his life stories. That's why we have this backdrop of San Francisco, even though you didn't need to do that. He just was absolutely insistent that had to be the star of the movie, that city.
Well, he certainly did a good job establishing that and giving it its fair share of screen time. I think anyone would come away certain of where that movie took place, and that's what's really important, I think, at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm surprised they're not, like, eating rice-a-roni in every other scene,
yeah.
just to drive the point home.
Eating Ghirardelli chocolate? Heard it both ways. Don't know the correct
Ghirardelli,
pronunciation.
Yeah.
Ghirardelli, okay. Hard G. Delicious stuff. The one time I went to San Francisco, I ate a lot of it. Mario, you've mentioned a couple of times, I think at this point, speaking of chocolate, actually seamless transition there. The only thing we've seen of her at this point is Michelle and Mark, who happen upon Johnny's place a little before everyone else show up. And so as to pass the time, as people do, they start eating chocolate off of each other's naked bodies. I think that's all we've seen of her at this point. But over the course of the movie, she is appears to at least be one of Lisa's best friends. What is it so much that you like so much about this Michelle character?
I don't really care about the character. I just think the actress is one of the few people in the movie who knows what she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you watch her. It's clear she's a decent actress. She's the one person in there you can really tell is doing her best to try to ground this movie with some semblance of reality.
Would you extend the same courtesy to Mike or not?
No. Hey, I noticed Colin earlier referred to Mike as Mark. It's odd that you would confuse such radically different and distinct and well drawn out characters.
I knew I would do that at some point, and I'm going to do it again, by the way, so stay tuned.
That's a Rizzo level error. He's officially Mark now. That's now canon.
Well, he was probably talking about Matt Damon, and he still screwed it up.
Yeah, I thought I heard Mike. I swear I heard Mike. This is also where we get another classic scene coming up here. Tommy, actually, this I think would be the point, if there was ever a point where we need to play the actual audio from the movie, which thanks to the miracle of technology we are able to do, I think this is the spot to do it. So let's roll the clip.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
So I want to ask you, Mario, I guess I'll start with, is this the most iconic line of the movie, or is it "You're tearing me apart, Lisa"?
Oh, it's this one easily. The tearing me apart one's kind of overrated. This one, when my wife and I saw this for the first time, and it was great because we didn't see this with a crowd. We didn't know any of the, you know, the lore behind the movie, all the interaction. We just saw it at home in our living room. This is the scene we kept rewinding and laughing. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe that's a take in a movie that somebody used. It's so stilted and awkward and just not the way that people say things in real life. It's like, who wrote this movie and who approved the script? And it's the end. Like you said, he has a little tantrum. He throws down the water bottle. And then he immediately, Mr. Bipolar, shifts into best friend mode. Oh, hi, Mark.
This is, I thought, one of the funniest sequences in the Disaster Artist movie is him trying to get this line right.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it took him like 30 takes or something.
Yeah, they're not exaggerating. This one scene took dozens and dozens of takes. And it's not just the blocking that he had trouble with, which explains the water bottle, which just comes out of nowhere, that he just throws to the ground. And that to me is what makes the line is he, in order to reach the end of a sentence, in order to keep this in the forefront of his mind, he needs to have this object that he can just hurl at something. And the way he does it in sync with the end of that line, it just adds so much to it for me. But one of the recurring themes throughout The Disaster Artist is, even though Tommy wrote this entire script and vigorously resisted any input into the lines or the dialogue or the pacing from anybody else, he, in theory, should have a perfect grasp of who's going to say what at what time. But even for his own lines, and even for very simple lines, it would take him dozens of takes just to get through one sentence. And even when they had audio that was maybe usable from that, there would be some other issue, like he wasn't facing the camera in the right way, or there was some other Tommy-related blunder that would derail that entire take. So every scene that Tommy was in was an ordeal for everybody involved. And you would be hoping, if you're Claudette, let's say, you would take solace in the fact that most of your scenes are off-screen with Lisa and nobody else, and Tommy doesn't have to appear anywhere.
Well, he still does have to show up. He still does have to show up with the camera.
Ah, yes.
But he's not thrusting himself into her belly button, at least.
That's the kind of thing that's going to give you breast cancer if you keep that up.
Oh, man.
So this scene, so much to unpack here, but when we skip ahead to Mark saying,
I used to know a girl. She had a dozen guys. One of them found out about it, beat her up so bad she ended up in a hospital on Guerrero Street.
That Guerrero Street clause was shoehorned in there by Mark at the end of, or by Greg, if we want to break character for a second, at the end of take 35, 42, somewhere in there, because he wanted something to jog Tommy's memory and to get him energized and to maybe make him remember his cue. And the only thing he could think of was to reference Tommy's real life address, which Tommy, if you read any of the material surrounding him, he hates anybody knowing anything about his background, his living circumstances, anything like that. So even though he will proudly bear his naked buttocks on camera for the whole world to enjoy, any hint that he maybe lived in a certain district of San Francisco is completely off limits. So he was furious at Greg for putting that in there. And yet, as you'll notice, that makes it into the film anyway. And the reason is, in however many dozens of takes it took them, because of Tommy, that was the only usable audio for that scene. And so eventually they said, fuck it, we'll just go with it.
Yeah, people are just very strange these days.
Yeah. Speaking of usable audio, there are also many spots where it's so obviously added in later. It's very funny. Like the dubbing is so far off and it still made it into the final cut of this movie with like I think it was like a $6 million budget, I read, at least according to Wikipedia, which, as we all know, is the concrete truth in every single circumstance.
Yeah, I got to comment on that. I don't know if you guys own the DVD or if you just watched this online somewhere, but
what's a DVD?
Yeah, sorry. On the DVD, there is a special feature. It's an interview with Tommy Wiseau where he answers questions about the film. And it's my wife and I, when we watched the movie for the first time, this was our favorite part of the whole phenomenon, watching Tommy's Q&A, because it's just simple questions like, what was the meaning of the football? What was the meaning of the rose? And even in this direct Q&A where it's him with a camera sitting, talking to a camera all by himself, half of it, at least 70% of it, is overdubbed. You can hear the dubbing because his audio was not clear enough. And the voice, it doesn't match. You can tell when it's an audio, when it's an overdub, because it's such a drastic, you can hear like the fuzz in the background changes, the tone, everything changes. And it's clear he's lip syncing to this overdub or whatever. And it's just the craziest thing. And that's the thing. He just cannot do live audio. He's kind of like, you know, our president, Donald Trump, on The Apprentice. Go to those early seasons, watch how bad he was at live audio. He could not do it either. It's Tommy Wiseau's the same thing.
Well, between, there was something else that made me feel that I was going to compare the two of them to. And now I'm, of course, spacing on it as soon as I tried to set that sentence up. So, Dom, please bail me out.
Well, I have no idea what you're going for, but if it comes to you, then by all means, jump right back
sure.
in.
Sure, stay tuned. Let's put a pin in that. That's a nice teaser for the remainder of the episode.
It's going to be you.
Oh, I remember what it was. I'm going to do it.
This could be one of those storylines that you bring up and it never goes anywhere.
No, I'm going to do it, though. It was him calling and pretending to be his own publicist was what I was going to compare it to Trump as well.
That Q&A, if you guys have never seen it before, seek it out. There's one in particular question I think is awesome where they ask him, like someone at one of the fans asks, what the hell is with throwing a football from 5 feet away? Like, do you even know how the fuck football works, Johnny? And Tommy answers the question literally. He's like, well, throwing a football is a fun game that people do many times, and I love to throw the football 5 feet away. It's a good sport. It's like he doesn't really even understand what the question is.
The next several scenes are just Lisa spreading the news to pretty much everyone other than Johnny that she's been unhappy in the relationship and seeing another guy. Mark is being very cryptic as well. Johnny keeps walking in on them, talking about secrets, but they're never willing to tell him what the secrets are. And then this is right around the point where we finally get the iconic, and I guess let's roll the clip once again.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
And apparently, Mario, this is, I didn't know this until actually seeing the disaster artist. I did know that he was heavily inspired by many people, including James Dean, but I didn't know this You're Tearing Me Apart was literally lifted from Rebel Without a Cause.
I'm going to blow your mind if you don't know the next part of this story.
I may not, so let's hear it.
Yeah, so Tommy Wiseau always compared himself to James Dean, because James Dean would always overact and scream and just, you know, tear this and chew the scenery. And so that's what Tommy Wiseau thought he had to do to become a big star like James Dean. And this scene right here was his tribute to Rebel Without a Cause, that You're Tearing Me Apart. But what you may not know, Dom might know this, is in the book, there's a big section here where Tommy actually remembered the quote from Rebel Without a Cause incorrectly. He actually got the wording of it wrong. Is that when he wrote the script and they started rehearsing it, Tommy kept saying, "You're taking me apart." And Sestero's like, "That's not the fucking quote, Tommy. Like, it's tearing." And so they argued, and John and Tommy's like, "No, it's taking me apart." And so they had to sit down and literally watch it again before Tommy could be convinced that he was saying the line wrong. So that's when you see the final version in the movie here, that's all Greg Sestero straightening Tommy out and just not letting him embarrass himself on film and actually saying, "Here are the exact words if you're going for the homage."
That is hysterical. I didn't know that. Yeah.
It's a thought that counts, and I'm sure James Dean appreciates the homage.
Yeah. Dom, and shout out to you, by the way, for back in Survivor Philippines thinking to use this as the episode title, because I can't even imagine where my life would be if I didn't find the room relatively shortly thereafter.
When I saw there was a contestant named Lisa on the season, I just earmarked it for the perfect time. And luckily, Lisa Welter gave us lots of material that season, so it was easy to slot that in there.
I can't believe you didn't go with any Simpsons references during that season.
I'm surprised too, but if we ever get the chance again, we can make up for lost time.
Lisa and Justice for Blood vs. Water 3, make it happen.
Yeah.
I was saying even better back in All-Stars that Dom had slipped another quote past you where Rob and Amber were having sex in the last episode, and Dom slipped in the quote, anyway, how's your sex life? So you may have missed that reference as well.
That's such a great scene where he's like, it's terrified of him asking personal questions. This immediately changes the subject to how's your sex life.
Yes. This movie, the gift that keeps on giving.
I want to see Tommy Wiseau as like an FBI interrogator or something, just trying to, and I think it would be oddly effective, if only because people would be so confused and so scared and so intimidated, they would just spill their guts. They wouldn't want to keep themselves in there for any longer.
So I guess at this point, as we roll through here, this is right around Johnny is bugging the phone now because he knows something's going on. He's going to catch Lisa in the act. And I think this is also where we meet Peter, who I think was supposed to be a bigger character that either got cut out or something went awry. And is this the Nathan Fielder character in The Disaster Artist?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, I had a lot. This was my first viewing since seeing The Disaster Artist, and I was really hoping this was the Nathan Fielder guy.
Yeah, the story behind there is they had this actor, Kyle Vogt, for like 30 days. That's how long he was contracted for. And because Wiseau was such a screw-up, the filming went on like 60 to 90 days or something. I forget how long. And so they had to bail. This actor had to bail and leave the production. And again, a deadline everyone knew was there, but because Tommy just sucked, that's they ran out of time, and that's why they had to replace the actor later in the movie.
Oh, okay. Because what happens is later on, a completely different guy shows up. But I thought I checked on Wikipedia, and I thought that was the guy who was listed as Steven. I didn't know he was supposed to be taking over the exact same role. Yeah. So that was supposed to be Peter in the end there.
He's surrogate Peter, yes.
Got it. Okay. He's the Marty Funkhauser surrogate hat wearing Peter.
I choose to believe that Mark actually did toss Peter over the edge of the building, and that Stephen is just the body double that they brought in to replace him.
It's seamless, though. You could never tell.
So, yeah, a lot going on here as Johnny's birthday is rolling around, and that's where a lot of the climactic action is going to happen. I guess we do have that we talked about that you're tearing me apart, Lisa. The one thing I did want to flag up about that is as he's yelling about what bullshit it is that she's going around talking about how he hit her, he does legit shove her into the chair as he's like screaming about how he'd never hit her.
I never noticed that. That's great.
He 100% does, like, at least arguably domestic abuse her as he's in the middle of this rant about how he would never do such a thing.
All right, when I do a funny 115 for the room, that's going on there. That's a great entry.
Oh, my God, can you please do that? Because you could easily fill out 115.
It wouldn't be still images from the show. It would just be a clip. It would just be an embedded video of the room with carefully dubbed commentary over it at various points. But this idea of shoving people into things apropos of absolutely nothing is a recurring theme that we see throughout when the boys get together for a nice friendly game of football, and Peter shows up and Mark just tags him, and he just flies into a bin that's lying in the corner of the room and has to like drag himself up and dust himself down. Never clear why exactly that happened or how he was able to put that much force into that light tap, but apparently it left Peter almost for dead there.
Yeah, we're like an hour into the movie here, and by this point, there's so many bizarre things that this scene doesn't even faze you. He's like, oh, Johnny just tackled Mike into a garbage can for no reason, and it's never mentioned again. It's just, all right, that's just how this universe works fine.
Well, there was some reason that he wanted the scene of them in tuxedos tossing the football around. What's the backstory on that, if we know?
I have never heard a straight answer for that one. I think it seems like it's set up for like a wedding or a funeral or a party or something they're all going to, but it's never explained. And Dom, do you remember why that scene is there?
I don't, and I don't think there's actually a reason. As far as I can tell, the most likely one, if there were, is that I guess Johnny and Lisa are going to have a wedding party or something, and then that gets called off, although not called off on screen, because that would be too conducive to guiding the plot forward. Instead, it's just taken out back and shot somewhere. That plot line is thrown off the roof of the building, like Peter was.
That's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. For people who don't know, this is the famous tuxedo scene where they're all there and Sestero comes in with a fully shaved beard and they zoom in on his face for no reason. And
yeah,
there's
okay,
no point to that. But it's the scene. I love the blocking of the scene because it's literally, it's Wiseau standing in the room and then Denny enters and Johnny says, oh, hi, Denny. And then Denny walks in, and then the door knocks again. The doorbell goes again, and here comes Peter. Oh, hi, Peter. And Peter walks in, and then literally right behind him is Mark, and it's like a fucking clown car. Like, they're literally 2 feet apart outside. And I literally also, they come in, oh, hi, Mark.
I love that later on in the movie, too, when Michelle shows up, instead of using the doorbell, she just knocks. I love that the first several people use the doorbell, and then later people are just knocking as if there's no doorbell there. But I have an update on the tuxedos from Wikipedia. I knew I had remembered reading about this earlier. So here we go. Quote, at one point, the principal male characters congregate in an alley behind Johnny's apartment to play catch with a football while wearing tuxedos. When Mark arrives, he's revealed to have shaved his beard, and the camera slowly zooms in on his face while dramatic music plays on the soundtrack. Nothing that is said or occurs during this scene has any effect on the plot. The scene ends abruptly when the men decide to return to Johnny's apartment after Peter trips. Wiseau received enough questions about the scene that he decided to address it on a Q&A segment featured on the DVD release. Mario, I'm sure this is the same thing you were talking about. Rather than explaining the scene, though, Wiseau only states that playing football without the proper protective equipment is fun and challenging.
That's what I love about him. He doesn't. When you ask him the question, you can see sometimes at these Q&As, he doesn't process like a normal person. He goes whatever stock answer he was going to give, even if it doesn't actually match the question.
I mean, he can say whatever he wants. Like, he doesn't even have to begin to answer a question, and people just take it for what it is and just move on.
Yeah. Well, in the book, if I recall, now I'm thinking back, there was a thing where Sestero had shaved, and it wasn't really in the script. And all of a sudden, you know, that it's kind of this creepy relationship in the book where it's like single white female a little bit, where Wiseau's a little attached to Sestero. And like, he was so enamored that his little sexy boy toy roommate shaved his face that he wanted to feature it and focus on it in a movie. And so that's why the scene is here, literally just because he wanted to show off how handsome his main star was that day.
I think I heard that he made him shave because he just wanted to call him Babyface at some point in the movie. I think somewhere along the way, maybe that's a myth, but I definitely heard something like that somewhere along the way that I think Greg Sestero was like surprised, like, why the hell do you want me to shave 2/3 of the way through this movie? But he thought it would be like worth it to call him Babyface just once, apparently.
It's a real slap in the face to any notion of continuity as well, because if you take a time-lapse video of Greg's facial hair throughout the film, it will just appear and disappear entirely at random. And then you would get these splotches, this 5 o'clock shadow just vanishing and then reappearing again. It's a complete mess from start to finish.
Yeah. I mean, those are the types of decisions the great directors make. Your Martin Scorsese's, your Hitchcock, your like James Cameron. I remember in Titanic, he's like, I want Kate Winslet to wear a pirate hat in this scene. Just, it would be cool. Let's just have that. So it's that kind of thing that the great directors can do.
Yeah. And incidentally, this is also where we get, I'm now remembering the details, which when laid out will certainly be funnier. It's Johnny and Mark meeting in a coffee shop, and Johnny's talking about how the bank he works for just landed a big new client. And Mark's like, oh, cool, who was it? And Johnny's like, oh, that's confidential, I can't tell you that. By the way, how's your sex life, Mark?
Tommy Wiseau's image of what small talk sounds like.
Yeah, well, I mean, very much just getting right to the point. He's at this point, obviously, more than suspicious about what's been going on between Mark and Lisa. And we're really amping up here for the big finale, Mario.
Yeah, I mean, Colin, you've gotten some lately, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, it's just that's one of my favorite lines because it comes out of nowhere. And that's just a glimpse into the mind of Tommy Wiseau. Just male characters asking about one another's sex life. That's the first.
That's how we do
opening
it.
Question.
That,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about what gets edited out of the podcast from time to time, and it's 99% that, just talking about random brags of that nature.
Yeah. Somehow this doesn't even crack the top five list of most inappropriate moments in the movie, though, which is a pretty impressive feat. But meanwhile, we are gearing up here for Johnny's birthday party. And as we alluded to earlier, the Peter impersonator slash replacement Steven makes a very brief appearance here. And he goes overshadowed by Peter and the story behind his disappearance, such as it is. But Steven himself is an interesting little wrinkle to this final scene, because you can tell There is no coherent idea behind what this character is meant to be. It's just, we have some scenes left over from Peter and this other dialogue that we forgot to cut and need to assign to some character. So we'll just bundle that all together and see what this guy can make of it.
Well, it's funny too, because Peter, like, the only thing we really know about Peter is he's a psychologist, so his advice is going to be very sage, and he is going to have a lot of intelligent things to say about how wrong Lisa's behavior is, and totally validate everything that Johnny wants to believe. So now we have this, like, are we supposed to take it for granted, I guess, that Steven is also a psychologist?
Yeah. Again, though, in my opinion, one of the most underrated awesome things about this movie is that Tommy Wiseau lost one of his main actors and main characters, so he literally just moved the dialogue onto another character we'd never met before. Then all of a sudden, this guy's spouting exposition and interacting with the main characters. We have no idea who this guy is. We've never seen him in the movie, and he's just walking around as if he's a main character. So it's just one of the wonderful things about this movie when you see it for the first time, just how weird that is.
I'm not even sure if the name Steven is used.
No, it's never used.
Yeah, you're reading the Wikipedia entry and you see the name Steven, and you're racking your brain to think who that was in the movie, and then you have to like look and find a picture or something for any of this to make sense. It's you really have to put the time in. But Steven acts as like the moral voice of the audience here, and he warns Lisa that, do you understand what you're doing? You're going to destroy Johnny. He's very sensitive. And yeah, Johnny's human. He's sensitive. He's probably more sensitive than most people. He just hides it behind a lot of things that he's done and accomplished, and behind a lot of machismo. But Steven, his warnings go unheeded. Lisa says she doesn't care. She's in love with Mark. They have this random makeout session just in the middle of the party, just for 10 or 15 seconds before all the characters randomly reassemble. And we finally get to what is going to be the big climax of the season here, as Johnny and Lisa and Mark finally work everything out.
Yeah, the denouement, as one would say.
Mm-hmm. The unfolding. The literal translation.
As Tommy Wiseau would say, if he were from some place in Europe, which he's not because he's a full-blooded American. But as we work towards this, Johnny is in characteristically good spirits. It's a beautiful party. She's invited all of his friends. Good thinking, Lisa. And she says, you're welcome, darling. You know how much I love you. I do. Ha, ha, ha. You know, it's getting really hot in here. Why don't we go back outside? Mm-hmm. Ah, ha, ha. Again. And Johnny has a big announcement to make. He's expecting. And as you would hope, everyone is very happy for him.
Well, people are very strange these days, and they're curing people of having a baby every day now, so don't worry about it.
They're curing all types of babies these days.
Babies are very strange.
Yeah. This is where we really dial the tension up to an 11, obviously, in this scene.
Yes.
Between Lisa and Mark. But it kicks off with them just like making eyes across the room. And then she literally, Dom didn't really do it justice. Lisa like ushers it prompts the entire party to just go outside, and very cognito hangs back with just Mark to like make out on the couch. And then laying on super thick with the expecting, which is it ever made clear? Because like Mark then later asks, oh, could this be my kid? Is she actually pregnant, or is this all just a lie? I'm still not even sure which way it goes on that.
It's a mystery wrapped inside a riddle, wrapped inside a fetus. We never know.
I feel like we need the room too, where she has the baby and we find out who the father was.
The baby
was
Denny
all along. Yeah,
exactly.
30 the whole time anyway. Yeah.
Inception.
Yeah. Well, regardless, we have one fight between Johnny and Mark that gets resolved for about 30 seconds, and then they get refueled, and then they go back at it. And Johnny at this point has had enough, and he decides to go upstairs, and that's going to be the last trip he's going to take up those stairs, I think. But is there anything more downstairs we need to resolve before we get to the big conclusion here, or anything we've skipped over to this point before we start wrapping on the plot itself? I don't want to get too far ahead.
Maybe the baby is werewolf.
It could be. I think a vampire father, very common for many werewolves. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, nothing's going on downstairs. This is Johnny going up to meet his fate, and it's sad. It's always a feeling of sadness when such a beloved character marches off to their final scene. We're about to see the death of poor Johnny.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess let's just get to it. And Dom, I don't know what you remember of my first time watching The Room, but I'm pretty confident I was like live blogging the entire experience to you by this point in the movie. And I certainly recall Watching this scene for the first time, once the gun came out, I am positive I was saying something along the lines of like, do it, do it, do it. Where were you guys on it as you guys were watching this movie for the first time?
I was going to say, surprisingly, I remember the gunshot. I remember Johnny killing himself. I'm like, well, that looks stupid. I for somehow missed the entire subplot that he's dry humping the dress right before he does that. Somehow I missed that the first time, and I had to read that in a review. I'm like, how did I miss him having sex with the dress? But he does that. So that was my reaction.
Yeah, knowing how the room has treated its plot point so far, I was expecting the gun to never be used, Chekhov style, and instead there was going to be some autoerotic asphyxiation style thing with the dress. But instead, we do actually get Johnny shooting himself after a little bit of resolving issues downstairs, as you might say.
Well, the thing for me is, like, I would never virtually ever be like that on board with that being like the big conclusion to any movie or like frankly piece of fiction of any sort, but for whatever reason I thought that was like frankly the only way I would be happy with this movie ending is of course Johnny has no real redemption as far as like his life getting better in any kind of way, and he just decides to end it because he's such a victim and every single person in his life is out to get him. And of course, anyone in this spot with surrounded by such malicious people really has no way out. I thought, this kind of melodrama had to go that route for it to really secure for me it was already certainly in the mega elite tier. Like, I was loving it the entire time I was watching it, but this to me is just like the perfect ending, and I cannot imagine saying that about like any other piece of media I've ever consumed.
Wow, it's the nicest thing anybody's ever said about The Room.
Well, I think it's telling that if I'm correct about this, I think like when they do these viewing parties, when he kills himself, like the room goes nuts, right, Dom? You've
yeah,
been to these.
Cheer.
They seriously do. And I think though, once the movie has reached this point, almost any ending that is in Tommy's range to drag this towards would be the perfect ending. So even if it's not him shooting himself, if it was some other grisly fate instead, it would look completely perfect and fitting in the context of The Room, because it's not playing by any rules. There's no consistency, there's no continuity, and whatever weird product of Tommy's mind was decided to be the final scene, that would have been okay in my book, and I'm sure in his as well.
Carte blanche at this point. The flying car would have worked.
Okay.
Here's my thought process on that ending scene. Okay, so Johnny's humping the dress. Is he aiming for the vagina part of the dress or the belly button part of the dress? Has he learned?
We don't need this to be a personal growth story, okay? Johnny is trapped in his own circumstances, and he's doomed to repeat them to the end of time. I think that's the message of The Room, when you have characters leaving and coming back in again over and over again, when Denny is just watching it all from the far, because he likes to watch you guys. You know, that's if The Room has any metaphorical significance, I think it's that.
So Johnny is Sisyphus. This is really a Greek drama all along.
Yeah, he has to thrust into the dress and then withdraw from the dress over and over again until the end of time.
And he can almost climax, but never quite.
That's The Room, based on the works of Sophocles.
That's right. Yeah, well, Johnny, the sirens start blaring outside as Lisa and Mark and Denny pops in one last time, but just for good measure, as he tends to do. He freaks out along with the rest of them.
Hold on. You say here on the notes, he demands both of them leave him alone with Johnny's corpse. For what exactly? What designs does Denny have on the naked ass of a dead Tommy?
It's great too, because he's screaming at them, get out, leave me alone, I need to be alone with him. And then as the movie fades to black, at no point do any of them leave. They don't even listen to him as he's screaming, get the hell out of here. They still stay and hang out, and they're just looking over as the camera lingers on Johnny's like lifeless corpse here for about probably 30 seconds longer than was necessary before fading to black.
Yeah, well, two's great, but three's a crowd.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess just closing thoughts on The Room as you've now wrapped up, as we've, I guess, wrapped up on the plot. Any major takeaways, any life lessons, Mario, about betrayal and the people you surround yourself with? Any philosophical insights or any, I guess, more sincerely, just parting thoughts on The Room as an actual piece of media and the way that it's kind of become achieved such cult status, as we put it, in the first place, and how it's gotten to that point in history.
Yeah, and again, this falls under the category of so bad it's good. And you hear that all the time. And you see that with movies like, you know, Sharknado and Birdemic. They do this thing on USA and Sci-Fi Network where they make these intentionally corny, bad movies, and they try to pass it off. Oh, it's so bad it's good. And I've never really loved those so much because there's a little too much self-awareness in them that they're bad. The Room is one of the very, very few organic examples of that, of somebody having the passion, the money, that's the big thing, the money, the resources, yet just the blazing incompetence, yet he was able to make this movie and throw it together and release it in theaters, and like it got an actual studio release or an actual like a premiere and everything at the theaters. But that's the thing, it's one of the very few movies that somehow reached that it's so bad it's good status, and it's just a bright shining example of how America can take something that's so pathetic and meaningless and turn it into something awesome and fun. So just as American pop culture in general, it's one of our proudest moments, I would say.
And that's the ultimate indictment of capitalism, that you have to think there are so many budding Tommy Wiseaus out there who don't have the great fortune to be able to devote to these projects. And if we give them the levers of opportunity, then how many more rooms will we be able to explore ultimately? But I would co-sign what you said about it working because it's not trying to be an intentionally bad movie. I think if you look at Tommy Wiseau's other work, so Best Friends, which it's more of a Greg Sestero creation, but Tommy leaves his paw prints on it as well. But then also Neighbours, which was this sitcom he was trying to get released a few years ago. If you look at those, some of them are entertaining in parts, but it's not good enough to actually be entertaining, and it's not so bad that it's good. It's just kind of mediocre, which I think is the worst space for any work to end up in. And with The Room, it's trying to be this bleak black drama, which ends up somehow as this amazing comedy. With Neighbors, it's trying to be a comedy and ends up just as nothing because it's Tommy Wiseau and he can't succeed at anything he tries. So I'm not going to say that failed because it had too much self-awareness, because that's not something you're ever going to say about a Tommy Wiseau creation, but it doesn't live up to the unintentional mission statement of The Room, and that might sound like a contradiction, but this entire movie is a contradiction, and that's what's so perfect about it.
I'll say it even shorter. I think Tommy Wiseau only works once. The minute he's kind of in on the joke, it's ruined.
I think The Room for me at this point, I've seen it many times, and I'm sure I will see it many more times. It is certainly the defining so bad it's good movie for me, and I'm sure I'm not alone in thinking that. And I frankly, I'm not sure if something like this can really be replicated. Maybe it will be. Maybe in one way it will be easier to find it's easier for the barrier of entry to get something out to a widespread audience with the internet now being so prominent everywhere, certainly that anyone's hearing this podcast. But I think, as you guys were saying, like, it takes someone like Tommy Wiseau, and it only works once. And I think one thing I wanted to bring up, and I hope this doesn't sound like xenophobic or anything like that, but I really wonder how much Tommy Wiseau's accent and look and personality really is necessary, or if this would have worked, say, for instance, Mara, if this was one of your favorites, like Coach Wade, say he hypothetically wanted to make his own movie and it didn't necessarily pan out as well as he had hoped, but people still found it really, like, ironically interesting. Do you think it could ever get to that same kind of status with someone less kind of mysterious than Tommy Wiseau at the helm?
No, I think you need the language barrier, and I think that's a very big part. And I'll go back to Mystery Science Theater. I keep mentioning that. It's one of my all-time favorite shows. And many of the best episodes I've seen on that over the years are when a director thinks they understand English and diction and just general sentence structure, but they don't, but they're confident enough to start writing dialogue as if they understand the language. Those are my favorite little things that you see in movies where, like, hi, I am being your friend. Oh, you are my friend. Is how about we go to park? Like, stuff like that. And this movie is just so chock full of that. So, you know, as much as you hate to say maybe it's xenophobic, you need that language barrier of just somebody not grasping American culture and American language and American relationships. That's why this movie is so special, just because he was so clueless in how people interact. He just didn't get it.
Yeah, I think, like Tommy Wiseau himself, The Room will forever for me be just kind of in a category by itself. I don't know if I'm ever going to find myself comparing any movie. I'm not a huge movie guy in the first place, but any kind of so bad it's good content in this same kind of pantheon. I'm going to have a hard time saying anything can really hit that for me the same way that The Room has over and over, and I'm sure will for a long time coming.
Yeah, people will try to replicate, but they never will. This is a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Yeah. Any other final thoughts on this movie or anything else you guys wanted to bring up while we're still on here?
I just have one that we didn't mention. I'll just throw this in there at the end here. Chris R., his name. This always kills me because his name is literally Chris-R.
Yeah.
And from the beginning, people have asked Tommy, why? Why is he Chris-R? That is not the way people write names in English. Like, is it Chris R? Is that part of his last name or what? And Tommy, he doesn't even get the question. He'll just say, well, Chris R is gangster. And they're like, that's not answering my question. Why is it Chris R? He never answers that question. He has to this day figured it out.
I've figured it out. This is a grown-up Christopher Robin from Winnie the Pooh who has shortened his name for the sake of brevity now that he's on the streets.
But why a dash? It baffles me. It haunts me at night, Colin. I don't grasp that dash.
I also like the Chris R as opposed to Chris P or Chris L, the other primary characters in this movie.
Oh, he's a gangster. Gangsters have last nicknames. Mm-hmm. Like, what? No, what? That doesn't make sense, Tommy. Who knows? I don't want to get too deep into Tommy's mind. I'll get lost in there.
Yeah. Well, Mario, thank you so much for coming on to talk with us about such a fantastic movie. This has truly been the podcast. Like, there have been many podcast that we've said for months, if not years, oh yeah, we definitely want to talk about that, and then we eventually do it. But this has been one that we've genuinely been dying to podcast about this movie since 2012 and have just been waiting for the right person with whom to do it. And I think Mario, you really knocked it out of the park, so thank you so much for coming on. And I didn't give you enough time at the start because I'm an idiot to talk about staff picks and so on, which I definitely want to do at the end. But Dom, anything else you want to get to before we wrap on The Room itself?
So I will quickly talk about the experience of watching a screening, first of all, but also watching one with Tommy and Greg there, because it's...
Oh, sure, yeah.
You watch a film by yourself, and you have your own roller coaster of emotions and reactions to it, as you would hope for. But watching it in a packed audience where everybody knows what's going on, everybody's in on the joke, and everybody comes armed with just an entire barrel load of plastic spoons ready to hurl at the screen whenever they appear in the background, it's a really sublime viewing experience. So I would urge anybody, however many times you've seen the film before, to tag along to one of those screenings, hopefully with other people if you can find it, because that kind of communal viewing experience, you can say that's a necessary part of just watching anything in a cinema, but this is really interactive, and I wouldn't recommend doing it as your first viewing, because it's hard to hear because people are talking over it, and it's hard to see because there's just a volley of spoons being thrown everywhere at all times, but it's a really memorable thing, at least on your first time. And if you can go to one where Tommy and Greg are in attendance, it really just raises the mood of the room, because you can tell that the audience is playing up to them as well. They want to stand out. They want to be memorable. And Tommy and Greg put on a great show, each in their own ways. And actually meeting Tommy was a real highlight of the whole thing for me. So
I was going to say, photos of Dom pop up every so often on my Facebook feed. The only one I can ever recall of Dom smiling is this photo with Tommy and Greg.
it was hard to restrain myself. And I, as Tommy was like barking orders to the person with my phone, trying to direct them on how to do it, I looked over to Greg and I said, thank you for just putting up with all of this. And he just kind of, he just nodded knowingly and smiled and didn't say anything. And that kind of sums up their whole relationship to me in a nutshell.
Yeah. Well, Mario, thank you so much for putting up with us for this long. You were fantastic. And now I think let's give you the opportunity to talk about your own movie podcast. This was a ton of fun, and I'm sure plenty of people would love to check that out as well. And anything else, obviously, that you would like to plug, because I know you got a lot going on.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Okay. So my big thing is my new one is Staff Picks. This is my movie podcast. This is just where I have a guest on. We talk about a movie that I think is underrated or underloved or just maybe needs a little more attention. You can find those episodes at staffpicks.podbean.com. It's also on iTunes. It's a really fun show. It's very loose. I have a different co-host for every episode, and some of them are real wild cards. I have some Survivor contestants on as hosts. I have one with a coach himself coming up in a couple of weeks. I have Brad Culpepper coming up. I've done Cass. I've done Randy. All sorts of fun stuff on that episode, on that show. I've put out about 45 episodes. That's a big one. The other thing is my Survivor stuff. The Funny 115 is my website. Most people, if they know Survivor, probably know the website. It's kind of what I'm known for. Funny115.com. That is my countdown of like what I think are the funniest moments in Survivor history. And I have been quite active in the Survivor community over the years. So that website has probably had about 3.5 million visitors over the years. It's pretty popular.
I remember very fondly back in the very early days of your writing, loving your old Survivor All-Star stories that you used to write. Are those still easily available somewhere?
Yeah, if you go to funny115.com, you go to the bottom, I have a link to my archives page, which is basically everything I've written about Survivor over the years, and that has all my old All-Star stories, all my columns. I was basically the first person on the internet back in the early days writing strategy columns on how Survivor strategy worked, how the game was probably going to play out, and you can see all my archives from back there in like Marquesas and Amazon, all the early seasons. So yeah, it's all on there, just I've never deleted anything.
And if people want to ask questions or give feedback about any of that, where can they leave their stupid comments in your pocket?
The best place is my Twitter, at Mario J. Lanza. I'm also on Facebook. I think it's facebook.com/Mario Lanza. You can find me. I have a very distinct name. It's a very ethnic Italian name, although I'm just some random white kid from Seattle. My mom just gave me a super ethnic name because she wanted me to stand out.
Yeah, well, there you go. Funny 115. Staff Picks, of course, Survivor Historians also going on with you. And I know you're also talking SNL with Mike Bloom lately. That may or may not be back, but that could be exciting as well for SNL fans. So thank you so much, Mario, once again. Dom is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone.
Can I say one thing before you leave?
Sure, yeah.
I want to interrupt one thing just before you sign off because you will appreciate this, hopefully. I will say I've been in the Survivor community for many years, one of the longest tenured Survivor fans out there. Been doing columns, podcasts. I will say, and this is no lie, there's one podcast I have seen over the years that everyone respects, everyone appreciates. I've never heard a bad word about it, and that is the Dom and Colin podcast. So I just want you guys to know the level of respect you have is higher than just about anybody I have ever seen over the years.
Well, thank you, although I have heard many bad words about it. Yeah, I thought you were gearing up for And It's RHAP or And It's Survivor Historian. So I was getting the old jokes ready, but it's fine. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, totally sincere. You guys have a level of prestige that I wish I could have. To be honest.
Well, thank you very much, Mario. And so, yeah, and thank you guys all. Whoever has made it this far is truly heroic in my eyes. We can't wait to hopefully talk some more movies now. I think now that we're getting kind of our feet under us. What's the expression? I don't even know at this point. It's pretty late at night now on the East Coast. So let's get everyone else. Let's get us and everyone else out of here. As I was saying, I am at Colin Stone on Twitter. You can email the show, domandcolin@gmail.com. And of course, get our weekly bonus episodes every Saturday at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. Right now, we are talking about Heroes versus Villains, which I know, Mario, you have coming up relatively soon on Survivor Historians. Although in Survivor Historians terms, that's probably like a solid 9 months or so.
Yeah, 6 to 8 months is probably when we'll debut Heroes versus Villains.
Very much looking forward to that. So I think that's going to do it. Let's just get out of here. Thank you guys once again. Take care, everybody. Yeah.
sweet.